Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Thank you. What's this for?
For Tuesday.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Okay, everybody. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Seems like we're a little thin this morning.
There's a talk right now on the Young's Red Book.
I see.
So I don't know if there's anybody else.
I would guess there are.
Yeah.
What's that talk scheduled to end?
It's 9 to 10. But most of us left it on break.
It was 9 to 10? So?
No, it's actually 11,
sorry,
11
to 12.
11 to 12.
Okay. Good morning. Is the ICP?
Yeah.
It's not going to meet in this room.
Oh, where's it meeting?
Next door, apparently.
Thanks.
Okay. I was looking at the feedback from students from last semester. I got halfway through it this morning, and one person suggested that I sometimes cut people's questions off and maybe assume what they're meaning, don't quite give them a chance to express themselves. So if I'm doing that, you let me know and just say, well, hold on a minute. I didn't quite get my question. Okay? So, this is a big class. And a discussion this large is very challenging. And I also discovered that part of the trick to it is finding the right balance between allowing the discussion to open and keeping it on track. Right? And so, I'm constantly making those decisions, and I may get off sometimes, and I'm totally open to feedback. So if any of you feel that I've shortchanged your question, please let me know, either right away or during the break or something, okay? Because I don't want to be doing that and having people frustrated. But I can't promise to be a lot more sensitive than I am because I'm sort of functioning at my limit here. So, okay? Okay. So questions, comments, observations, ongoing considerations from previous classes. Can you close that? Is it possible to read it? It's self-explaining.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if these are closed or not. Maybe not. Okay. Okay, that's all right.
I want to say that I actually really appreciate the fact that it's not that you cut people off, but I've always been taught if you can't say something in like 10 seconds, then don't say it. And so sometimes I actually really appreciate it because it seems like you act as a great catalyst for getting people to say what they need to say and then move on. So I guess maybe I'll get a double gratitude of your comments, but
what do you think it's about?
I find it really valuable that you do that.
That I do what?
I think you have a really great way of getting people to get what they need to say and then moving on in the conversation. And when people get really far off track, bringing us back and maybe not going full into the question, I actually really appreciate that about.
Actually, I appreciate that. As I say, it's always a balance I'm trying to make, and I really appreciate that. But I just want you to know, if you feel like cutting you off or didn't hear you fully, I really want to know. Okay, so I just want you to think I'm going to be too rough about it. I'm not interested. So, but thank you for that. I appreciate that. Okay, so yes.
So I'm thinking about a quote in the Burt book. And I didn't bring it, but basically he talks about Newton and how he didn't really define substance and, some of these basic things that, like, Whitehead defined. I wish I'd brought the book. And he talks about how Newton threw a cloak of positivism over his version of science.
Yeah.
And positivism as a philosophy wasn't sort of officially named and talked about until the 19th century, by Comte and people like that.
Thank you, the 20th.
In the 19th.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the word gets thrown around a lot. And in fact, it was just tossed out in this Jung talk that a bunch of us were at. And it's like, I think it's really important for people to understand what positivism is. And I'd like to understand it too. So can you talk about that?
Well, frankly, I'm not sure I can do a great job on it. What do you know about positivism?
Well, to me, it's interesting because, Whitehead starts with experience, but he starts with it in a different way from the British empiricists,
yep.
Where they start with, they really break experience down into qualities,
right.
You know.
Quality.
Huh? Qualia, yeah.
It's important, because a qualia is an instance of a quality.
Okay.
Rather than just a quality. So they break it down right. Instances of quality.
Right. Right, yeah. And there's a certain rootlessness. I mean, to me, one thing for me about positivism is that I just have this mental image of it as something that doesn't really get into, it doesn't really engage with reality in a deep way, because it's kind of, you know, deracinated.
Could you define positivism for those of us who aren't?
Well, that's where I'm trying to go with this. Well,
here's my suggestion.
Yeah.
I would like you, over the week, to spend a little bit of time researching positivism.
Okay.
And come in next week and give us a little presentation about it.
Sounds like a plan.
Excellent.
Okay.
Okay, great. Next week you'll have 15 or 20 minutes to tell us about positivism and how it's related to what we're doing here. I'd be grateful. Okay. I could use it too.
Yeah. Thank
you. All right. Excellent. Great. Okay. Anything else that anybody'd like to bring up? Maybe you guys can move in a little closer. Just feel like this vast space over here.
I keep thinking about rigid rods and periodic
oscillators. Yeah, I'm thinking about them. Well, you know, I get that. Hard stop thinking about those things.
But one area where I've noticed maybe a conjunction of two, because you have two measurements and you only make one measures the other. You have them in relation to each other, time and space. It's hard to think about time without space and space without time.
Absolutely, you can't.
So they have to have like a reference to each other, and a rigid rod is a reference of one to the other, and so is a period oscillator. That's what makes them kind of different, it seems. I was thinking about like a sound and light waves and how they have both frequency, period, and they also have wavelength spatial measurement. And that was one, I thought that might be an interesting point of crossover between time and space was,
yeah,
you know, light or sound, no matter what the medium, but the idea of, you know, a frequency equals a wavelength at the same time. So, because I'm thinking about in terms of, we talked a lot, I think, in spiritual terms of higher frequencies and moving up into higher.
We're going to talk about that a lot today. So let's come back to that. We're talking about frequencies and what that means and so forth as a metaphor.
But every frequency has a wavelength. That's my point. It actually has a distance that it's associated with.
So what's the point you're making?
Just that I find that interesting, that there's this, that's the one thing I was thinking that has.
Well, you know, it is clear that there is a very intimate relationship between time and space. That's obvious. And the intimate relationship between time and space plays out differently in the different mutations of consciousness. Right? So the notion of extended space doesn't become relevant until the mental mutation. That's something important to keep in mind. But, you know, but you're right. The relationship between space and time is an immensely fruitful area for philosophical investigation. They're always intrinsically connected. How is a very, very deep and important issue, I agree.
And when we talk about sound versus visual, aural versus visual, right? Being visual of mental mutation,
yeah,
and aural being some of the other mutations. I mean, like, what is the real difference between those in terms in frequency, they're just a different.
Well, you know, I don't want to go there right now because I want to talk a lot about the whole frequency metaphor.
All right.
As we go on today, it's going to be an important topic, so we'll come back to it. Okay. Anything else on your minds, or shall I? So let's talk about, yeah, Chris.
One question that I had about we talked about efficient and deficient.
Yes.
The mental.
Yes.
State. Is there a notion of efficiency and deficiency in the magic of the myth?
Yes, there is.
And is. Does he develop that, like, in relation to the other
yes.
Developments?
Yes, it's sort of like this. This is discussed extensively in The Ever-Present Origin. But you can sort of visualize a mutation as an arc. So let's say this is the mythic mutation, right? It started out, and then it reaches a certain peak, and then it begins to go deficient, right? And what happens, right as it reaches its peak, the new mutation starts like this, right? So at the peak of the mythical, let's say at the time of the great theodicies, like you know, Hesiod's, right, which began to unify the whole of mythic space, mythic understanding into one overall scheme, there's sort of a mastery of mythic space. But at the same time, myths becomes questionable at that point, because you've got one overall story, but you've got all the different myths and all the different cities and all the different civilizations, and people start thinking, well, if the animals had gods, they looked like animals. So all these like questions come up, right? So what happens is, as the mythic peaks, the mental gets started. And right when the mental gets started, the mythic goes deficient. So this is the deficient all the way down, right?
So the idea of deficiency is in relation to the emerging new paradigm.
That's exactly right. And so then we have the mental mutation.
Right. Next door.
ICP?
Yeah.
Next door.
Okay, we're just next door. Huh?
Yeah. Okay, so then we have the mental mutation start, right? And the mental mutation, probably right around here, is where the Greeks happen, you know? It sort of like breaks out. And then the mental goes all the way up to the Renaissance. And the mental mutation peaks in the Renaissance with the articulation and discovery of perspective, which represents a mastery of space, because the mental mutation is all about space, right? So we get to the Renaissance, and then right there, at the Renaissance, we get the beginning of the integral. Right? And one of the figures I think is very pivotal is Nicholas of Cusa, who has this idea of God as a coincidentia oppositorum, as a union of opposites, which is a very integral idea. And at the same time, as you see Nicholas of Cusa with this wonderfully integral understanding of God, he then talks about the universe coming into existence by contractions of God. And so the first of God's contractions is the contraction into geometrical space. So for Nicholas of Cusa, space is an expression of God, and then the individuals come out of space by a further contraction. So what's really interesting is that Nicholas of Cusa, you see this fully integral vision of God, at the same time you see this totally perspectival vision of space. So he's right on the border between the mythic and the mental in some way there, right? And what happens here at the Renaissance, once space gets mastered, is that the issue of time begins to become relevant. And so if you'll notice that all the early scientific theories have to do with changes over time. How fast does a falling body accelerate? How fast do things move, right? These are all logical descriptions of processes of transformation. Up until this point, transformation has been sort of an embarrassment for thought. Right? The Greeks thought that there was a realm of pure static knowledge, pure form, that never changed. And that the phenomenal world is this constantly changing environment where the mathematical and formal relations never are quite accurate. So you can't really expect to understand the physical world mathematically for the Greeks. And also, they're really big into the whole idea of substance. And the idea of substance, that it's something that doesn't change through time. Right? So, but when you get to the Renaissance, all the attention shifts to transformation over time. All the great mathematical equations describe transformations that are happening in time. And so time breaks through right after the Renaissance. And somewhere along here you get the theory of evolution and so forth. And we're probably right about here with the integral beginning to break out the deficient mental. So that's right. And the other thing about efficient and deficient is that, as far as I can tell, in the efficient phase of the cycle, there's a very strong sense of unity. That there's some sense of trying to synthesize and to reveal the unity of the world in relation to God's unity and wholeness. And this seems to be the case in the whole efficient phase of each cycle. And then once it's sort of achieved the synthesis, it then gets sort of broken down and used for individual purposes of various kinds, and the basic overarching sense of unity gets lost, and you go into the deficient phase. And you can see this very clearly in the mental mutation, where up until the Renaissance, the whole project was a metaphysical project of demonstrating the unity of the universe in God. And then right at the peak after the Renaissance, everything becomes individualized. How does the individual function in the universe, right? And all the locus of value shift to the individual. And so scientists these days, it's quite remarkable. I keep talking about these scientists I work with at Esalen. Michael Murphy sent out an email to everybody in the group saying, well, there are some things I think we all agree on. And the first thing I think we all agree on is that the universe is some important sense one. The scientist freaked out. They wouldn't hear him.
They said, that's too mystical, and if we said that, we wouldn't be allowed to function as scientists anymore. Now, I find this remarkable because the whole premise of scientific work is that the universe is one and unified under a single body of natural laws that are universally applicable. Right? So the premise of science is the unity of the universe, without which science makes no sense. You can't understand science unless you understand it as an attempt to unify the entire world of experience under a framework of mathematical relations, where that framework is one framework unifying the universe. That's what science is aiming toward. That's what a grand unified theory would be. And yet, scientists deny the unity of the universe because it's somehow embarrassing to them. It's interesting, isn't it? How people function, is what they think and stuff. Anyway, so where was I? So I'm talking about the mutations, and how, and we can see how, since the Renaissance, there's been this increasing fragmentation of disciplines, fragmentation of people, fragmentation of families, and so forth.
But it's not that easy, because the mutation can start even after the, or there are actually several streams or currents.
Yeah, yeah, it's not. There's
a lot of hybrids.
Yeah, a lot of hybrids, and all kinds of things are going on. I read that Gebser said, places the beginning of the mental mutation at around 1200 for the Jews, 500 for the Greeks, and 1250 for the medieval Europeans. Right? So it's complicated. This is a very abstract, oversimplified representation of something which in practice is much more complex and messy. Absolutely. Hmm.
What were those times again? Was that 1200 BCE?
Yeah. Yeah, for the Jews.
For the Jews, and then the Greeks were next, and then Europe caught
up. Right, right. Later. And maybe that's why the Jews are so smart. You know, we've been in mental mutation for longer. I don't know.
What about the deficient integral? Is that
not so far ahead of us? I'm not even going to think about it. Okay. Yeah.
I got a question about the use of the word mutation.
Yeah.
Because of my science background, I'm always thinking of it in genetic terms, and what I'm getting, what he means it is more. Well, more like transformation.
Yeah. He's not using it genetically. He's not using it biologically. He's at great pains to separate his usage from the biological usage of the term.
Why did he want to use that term and work so hard?
Ask him.
Yeah. But he did have a purpose in that he saw biological mutations happening rather quickly. And so that's the sense in which I understand him using that or borrowing that term. He calls it a mutation because it happens quickly, rather than, I mean, again, various time scales, it's different. But, you know, it's quickly, relatively speaking.
Right.
And that's why he calls it a mutation, not because it's, like, related to biology.
Yeah.
Listen, here's biology. The thing, Joe. Here's the thing. Yeah. If you want to do philosophy, you have to learn to hold the definition of words very lightly. Otherwise, you can't do philosophy, right? And so what that means is that as you read each different philosopher, you have to teach yourself their vocabulary, right? And so to try to import other definitions of the term into the thinking of a philosopher is just a source of unnecessary confusion.
Can't help doing it, but yeah.
Right. But the trick is to learn not to,
yeah.
Right? It's a discipline. Right, and so you know, so you read a word like soul, or consciousness, or mutation, or substance, right? And these terms each have so many meanings, right? That there's simply no to say what does the word mean is meaningless. The question is how is the word used in this context, right? And so you just have to learn to be light about that. Yeah, you're going to bring in your old associations, but then you have to learn to quickly pare them down. Right, and so as you read each philosopher, you're in effect reading a new language. Right, and so this is part of the art of philosophizing. Right, is learning to hold word definitions more lightly, so you can shift back and forth to different definitions as you go from author to author. This is part of the training. Right.
Can you just repeat Nicholas of Cusa's term for God again?
Like, coincidentia. Co-
coincidentia oppositorum. Which means a coincidence of opposites. Okay. So let's talk about the readings. What do you guys think of Ledbetter? How many of you read, how many of you did the reading? Good. Okay, what do you think of Ledbetter? Anybody have a comment? Yeah.
Yeah, because they were, you said that was one of the early things that you discovered. That,
yeah.
That led you out of the science world.
That's right.
And it's quite elaborate, and I'm amazed how compatible it is with spiritual teachings that I know about.
Right. That's right. Because a lot of the spiritual teachings of today are sourced in theosophical ideas.
I'm curious about that,
So it's historically quite important, much more so than you'd think. Yeah.
Well, yeah, one thing that came up in the study group is that there's an article in the New Yorker this week that's an expose of Scientology. And reading the stuff in there, it's like the guy, L. Ron Hubbard, who started Scientology, really was just kind of drawing stuff wholesale from this and other similar traditions.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, most of our ideas about mystical and occult, especially about occult processes, come from this theosophical basis. Right, this is a sort of early synthesis, and it's had basically the whole New Age culture grows out of this. This is sort of in the West, in America, this was the beginning of New Age culture. It was the Theosophical movement coming over here. Yeah.
And my understanding is that Blavatsky and Bailey were some of the first to articulate the concept of the New Age itself.
Could be. Yeah. Yeah. That's probably right. Yeah. So there's a whole history here. I haven't looked into it very deeply, but a number of books have come out recently about Blavatsky and the movement and how it fit into culture and so forth. And it's actually, I think it had a big impact. The mainstream never picked it up, so it's always been sort of in the background, but it affected a lot of people, including me, massively. But a lot of other people were affected by this. So it's culturally, historically, extremely important. Yeah? I forgot your names now.
Michael. I think one of the first things I notice is how you can almost interpret this as a strict materialism.
Yes!
I don't know whether to be bothered by that or just to say, all right, yeah, that's the merit of materialism, is that you can at least attempt to explain everything in its terms.
I think you should be bothered by it. And I think both things you said are true. Right? So it's really interesting to see how the theosophists attempted to expand the materialist interpretation. And you ought to be disturbed by the fact that this is a materialistic interpretation, because for that reason, it doesn't work, right? So it's a really interesting attempt, but doesn't work precisely because it's still materialistic. Now, what's the problem with materialistic understanding? Why is it a problem?
For me, it never really negotiates between how you get from particular, how does an individual form, or how do you go from an individual or to an individual? It doesn't really make sense.
Excellent.
If a body is closed, it's always closed.
That's right. So there are deep philosophical problems with materialism. One of them is that it posits these objects, but never says how they get there and what their relationship to the whole is, right? And so you end up, materialism is fundamentally incoherent in that sense. Whitehead points out it. This idea of coherence is extremely important. I talked about it here. The idea of coherence is that the universe is one. I mean, we have to assume that, right? And that the task of philosophical work or any human knowledge endeavor is the attempt to locate each individual factor of experience in a larger context, right? So to understand something, part of what it means to understand something is to articulate its relationship to the whole of which it is a part. Right? So we understand the movements of the planets when we understand how all the various planetary bodies are influencing each other to create the system of the solar system. Right? So it's like we place it in a larger context. That's part of what understanding is. And so philosophy always, and science, whether they admit it or not, both philosophy and science are attempts to articulate the overall unity and coherence of experience. Right? That's just, I'm just saying that, and I'm hoping you believe me, because if you don't, I can't really say anything else about it. It's just a basic idea. And so Whitehead says that if our philosophical thought is going to display the coherence of reality, the basic ideas that we propose for understanding reality must be coherently interrelated with each other. Right? Does that make sense? So Whitehead has this very technical definition. He says that concepts are coherent. A set of concepts is coherent when what is distinctive about each cannot be articulated apart from a reference to the others. Right? What is distinctive about each cannot be articulated apart from a reference to the others. Right? So they all hang together in one interdependent system. So when all your basic explanatory notions are interdependent with each other, you're exhibiting the unity of the universe and accomplishing the philosophical project. Okay? Let me give you some examples of what incoherent philosophy looks like. Descartes' philosophy is systematically incoherent in this sense. Descartes says, a substance is something which needs nothing other than itself and God to exist. Think about that, right? A substance is self-existing. It just is what it is, no matter what. And then we have two kinds of substance, mental substance and extended substance. And each one is an individual thing that doesn't require the other. So now we have an incoherent universe in which we have two different things, neither of which requires the other, and neither of which is intrinsically related to the other. This is called the mind-body problem, right? The mind-body problem is a result of an incoherent philosophy. It's simply bad philosophy that lands us in the mind-body problem, right? Because it just simply exhibits the fundamental incoherence of the categories. You see that? Now here's another completely incoherent philosophy. It's Newton's philosophy, in which we have three-dimensional extended space, linearly unfolding time, and point masses, which are the atoms, and none of those requires any of the others. They're all independent. Space would be space, whether or not there are atoms in it. Atoms would be atoms whether or not they're in space. And time would flow independently of space, and space will exist independently of time. You've got various incoherently posited building blocks which have no reason to be together. There's no fundamental relationship between atoms and space, atoms and time, and so forth, right? It's completely incoherent. The universe couldn't possibly be like that, right? So you see how once we understand this idea of coherence, many of the perplexing issues of modernity disappear immediately. You follow me? Right. Now, where are we going with that? What did I respond to with that?
Sounds like strict materialism.
Right, so materialism is incoherent. And in particular, in materialism, there is no intrinsic relationship between things and consciousness. They're completely separate. Now, if consciousness and things are completely separate, right, we have the mind-body problem coming out of Descartes, and the theosophical solution to the problem does not address the mind-body issue. Right? Because you're basically saying, okay, there's physical stuff out there in three-dimensional space, and now there's other stuff out there in three-dimensional space. But it doesn't know anything about consciousness, right?
And so it doesn't really help. It leaves all the problems of materialism unsolved. Okay, so you're right, Michael. You got it. But the idea itself remains really interesting. It's interesting because it shows us something important about the nature of thought. It shows us something important about programmatic thought or paradigmatic thought. So materialism is a program of explanation. That makes sense? The materialists say, we now have identified this abstraction which we call the physical world, and we've now made the move of misplaced concreteness and decided that the physical world is what exists, independently of its being observed, which is just nonsense because it's never not observed. But in any case, so we think there are these things out there, okay? And these things out there are space and time and energy or stuff, whatever, however, depending on the stage of science we're at. And the knowledge program is this. Let's see if we can identify interesting phenomena in our experience and account for them as interactions among atoms or energies in three-dimensional space. It's sort of a game, right? It's like when you sit down at a computer, you have a programming language, and you have something you want to achieve, right? Maybe you want to create a database, and you have Lisp or C++ as your programming language, right? So now the task is, how do I take the various operations defined in the language, the C++ language, and configure sequences of them that will function as a database? It's what they call hacking. You hack it out. So what a scientist does is a scientist says, okay, I've got this phenomena, and I've got this language, the materialistic language, and now I want to see if I can write a program in materialistic language to account for this phenomenon. Right? So for example, the sun's up there, and it's a big shining thing. And so I'm a materialist, and I want to account for it. Right? And so I account for it as a thermonuclear explosion. Right? So now I found some way to take this incredible phenomena, the sun, and reduce it into a materialistic explanation. It's programming. It's hacking. Right? And so usually, often when we read science, we get this feeling that we're actually somehow delving into the way things really are. But if you actually look at what science is, it's all hacking. Right? It's taking a phenomena and trying to produce a program that will make that phenomena intelligible in terms of the materialistic language of science. Right? And it's just hacking. It's just programming. Right? See what I'm getting at? Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm first of all, as a programmer, hacking works though, and that even that is philosophically suspect, that term. But so,
what?
You know, just to take the example of the sun, you know, understanding as we seem mostly to believe that there are thermonuclear explosions going on in the sun, that comes nowhere close to exhausting the nature of the sun.
That's
but
right.
On the other hand, it does give us some understanding of what's going on.
It does. You know, but then, for example, there are a lot of people now who claim the sun is not a thermonuclear explosion.
Yeah.
Right? That it's actually a plasma.
Right.
A plasma transformation that's going on as galactic energy enter the solar system.
Right.
So it isn't thermonuclear at all. So
well,
point
so in that case, like, wrong, you know, but still, it's like, you know, there are other things where, you know, yes, seawater boils at a certain temperature.
I'm not saying science is not right. I
mean, yeah.
You know, the programming sort of works, and you can play with it and do things with it. But I am pointing out that it's a program, that the activity of explanation, right, is a reduction of the phenomena into the language, into the programming language, in some way. Right? Now, it's useful, and it works because nature herself seems to function in this way. It's a functional operation, and so if our programming language adequately represents certain functions that nature is performing, right, then we get some insight. I'm not saying it's irrelevant, but I am pointing out that a lot of time when you read scientific explanations, they're just hacks. Yeah.
So are you saying that theosophy is similar in the way?
Yes, it's a hack.
And?
Yes.
When we're thinking about what we're going to do in the transphysical realms, aren't we kind of going to do something similar too?
but different. See, that's why I like it. It's a really interesting example, but it doesn't quite work, right? And all of my work is basically, in the book we're going to be reading, is a reformulation of theosophy in a way that does address the issues that materialism can't address.
But isn't it just a different programming language?
Yes, it is!
Okay.
Absolutely. It's a different programming language.
So it is a hack.
It's a hack. It's all hacks, right? That's what we're doing, right? Okay, so let's look at what the theosophists did. Okay, so just set up, right? We've seen in our exploration of the mutations of consciousness and our speculations about human history that the transphysical worlds have been an intimate part of waking life throughout human history, and that many of our ancestors were quite explicit about acknowledging them, and that they were just part of life. It just wasn't a big issue, right? Like, for the magical people, the transphysical worlds and the physical are completely mixed up. In the mythical world, there's sort of a polarization between the physical and the transphysical, life and death, and so forth, right? But then when we get to the modern world, we create this picture of objective reality which completely excludes the transphysical worlds. This is the only civilization in history that's tried to deny the existence of what is so obvious to everybody, right? And so along come the theosophists, and on the one hand, they have this spontaneous, intuitive awakening to the reality of the transphysical, which many of us feel. We just know it's there. And then this materialistic understanding, which excludes the transphysical completely. Right? So they're stuck. What are they going to do? Right? So they do the obvious thing. They try to make a scientific accounting of the transphysical worlds. They say, okay, well, here we are in the late 1800s. Science is utterly triumphal. There's no point in trying to get people out of science. Let's see if we can include the transphysical world. Let's see if we can express the existence of the transphysical world in scientific language. And so they make several really interesting moves to do that. And the first one is they want to talk about transphysical matter. Now, we don't think about transphysical matter in the modern world because we think all matter is physical and measurable and exists in three-dimensional space. But if we begin to ontologize the collective unconscious, as I've been discussing, if we begin to realize that our dreams take place somewhere and that the entities we perceive in our dreams do have an actual existence, how can we formulate that actuality? But the question is, how can we say that the transphysical worlds are actual if we're stuck in materialistic language? Right? So they come up with several very clever ideas. So the first one is, they say, we notice that matter comes in various degrees of density. So they have this idea of density. And then they say that we can identify in the physical world three grades of density, which is solid, liquid, and gas. That's okay, that's kind of interesting. I mean, I'm not sure density applies, we'll get back to that. But it's kind of interesting, right? And so now we have a sequence, solid, liquid, gas. We could add plasma in there if we're a little more modern, right? And then they would say, okay, let's just continue that series. Solid, liquid, gaseous, plasma, etheric, astral, and mental. Right? They just take that same sequence and project it up. And so now there's a bid to account for transphysical matter, transphysical stuff, as less dense than the physical. Now, what does that gain? Well, it gains us something about how the transphysical worlds can interpenetrate the physical. That's important, right? So now they say this subtle matter that's above plasma in this hierarchy is so subtle that it can coexist with physical matter. Right? So that right here in this room, we're functioning on this dense level, but on some more subtle level, there are whole other worlds that are taking place, occupying the same space, but we can't perceive them because our senses aren't tuned in the right way. So, what's accomplished by this? What's accomplished
is some way of saying that the transphysical worlds interpenetrate the waking world. It's what I call in my work the transphysical dimension of the waking world. And now we've secured it materialistically, right, with this idea of density. Then they say that this matter extends beyond the surface of the Earth. Right, so the astral plane, let's say, goes halfway to the moon. Okay, right? Now, what does that mean? It means that there are regions of the transphysical worlds that are not interpenetrating the physical, which is also very important for an understanding of the transphysical domains, right? So their insights are correct. There is something we're going to want to call subtle matter. I agree with that. And it partly interpenetrates the physical, and it partly transcends the physical. All those things are necessary truths in a multi-world cosmology. But what the theosophists have done is, first of all, they've tried to explain this increasing transphysical matter, increasingly transphysical matter, in terms of a metaphor of density. Right? Follow that? And then in terms of space, they've now made three-dimensional space the location of the transphysical worlds. Right, because the transphysical worlds are now represented as occupying three-dimensional metrical space and have therefore been brought into the physical world in this kind of crude way. Okay, so that's this model. Notice that this notion of density reflects a very substance-oriented approach, right? Because it's quality of the substantiality. Physicists actually wouldn't use density for this. They would use energy level, right? So that liquid is at a higher energy level than solids, and gas is at a higher energy level than liquids, right? But it's not really about density. It's about energy level, right? Energy level is functional, whereas this idea of density is substantial, right? So scientists don't actually use this kind of thinking anymore. It's way outdated, even for scientists. But it's still interesting to see what they were trying to do, right? Because who said that about the Hacky Linda? Or you, right? It's like I'm trying to hack out a theosophical system, just like they did, right? But I can see that a materialistic version doesn't work, and so I'm making a process version. So that's why I find this so interesting, because the project is the same project, but the tools they're using aren't adequate. You with me? Density is not a good enough way of expressing what we mean by transphysical.
The density is inherently really just distance, is that right, would you say? Distance between
well, from yeah, maybe. I don't really want to get into a deep analysis of this, because it's very complicated and not that interesting.
I'm just pointing out that, like, we're back to distance again. So even though, so yeah, it's all materialization.
Yeah, exactly. It's all materialization. Right? Absolutely. You got it. Thank you. Thank you. Now another word that they use, this does not occur in Ledbetter. I think this comes in a little bit later, is frequency. That's now we're talking about frequency. Right? So the idea is that somehow transphysical matter is at a higher frequency than physical matter. Now, I don't really know what this means, frankly. It just seems like a poor metaphor for several reasons. One is that frequency is a measure of vibration, right? It's just a matter of some sort of oscillation, right? So does matter oscillate? Well, maybe matter oscillates, you know? I mean, we can make some sort of case for that. But if we do make a case for matter oscillating, it's having some periodic time of expression. For example, Whitehead would say that an atom cannot manifest at an instant. It can only manifest over a period of time sufficient for the whole complex pattern of atomness to manifest. And the more complex something is where the longer it takes to manifest. Now, if we think about frequency that way, it'll become more intelligible later, but if you think about frequency as that way, then the slower the frequency, the more subtle the matter, right? Whereas the theosophists want to say the higher the frequency, the more subtle. So that doesn't seem to work. Now, we could say something maybe about higher frequency being a metaphor for higher energy, and then it might work, right? But sort of, right? It's, I consider the frequency a very crude metaphor that I can't quite make sense out of. But it's sort of like density. It's another attempt. See, the thing about frequency and density both, let me go back. In scientific thinking, the first thing we do with any phenomena we want to study is we look for some variable we can identify in the system, some numerical variable. Let's say, for example, we have a system of gas, we have a box with gas. We want to study, you know, how the gas behaves, right? And so we identify three quantities, pressure, temperature, and volume. And there are equations that describe this, right? And we notice that the configuration of the gas changes as we vary the numbers. Right? Temperature is a linear variable. It goes from zero to something, right? And pressure is a linear variable. And volume is a linear variable. And so the whole system is decomposed into linear variables. Right? And so what science is fascinated by is the technique of accounting for qualitative variation in relation to quantitative variation. Right? That makes sense? Right? So, you know, like I want to talk about intelligence, right? And so I create a line, the IQ line, right? As like I find some number, and I say, as this number varies, people's personalities vary in some important way. Right? That's an example of linearization, right? It's an abstraction out of some linear variable. So density is an attempt to abstract out a linear variable that we can see in the physical world and project into the transphysical. Same thing with frequency. Right? Frequency is a numerical measure, right? Frequency has some number. And so the number is low or high. And so there's an attempt to account for the qualitative variation of matter in the different transphysical worlds in terms of this number, which is the frequency number. And so this is the scientific method in some way, right? It's to take some complex qualitative phenomena and to identify measurable variables within it and to account for the qualitative variation in terms of quantitative variation. Yeah.
So I just had this sudden image when you were talking about the temperature, pressure, and density relationship that related back to your saying that Newton's whole system was incoherent. And I'm trying to understand a little more deeply that relationship. So temperature and pressure are separate incoherent, and yet they're related.
They're not, you see, because temperature and pressure and volume are three abstractions from the same phenomenon.
But as when they're I guess I'm trying to get more into the philosophical roots of Newton's errors and those kinds of people. And so it seems to me that when you make them when you render them abstract, you're turning them into things that are, in that context, not coherent with each other in a certain way. And yet they have a relationship. Maybe I shouldn't be talking about this. I should go home and think about it. But this somehow relates to what you were saying about
it does, because basically, what happens in science is, we do. The different measurable dimensions seem to be self-standing. And then we find external relationships between them.
Yeah,
and those external relationships are the equations of physics.
Right. And it's that thing about externality that I'm trying to really understand more.
Yeah, basically, the tendency of scientific thought, all the way back to Democritus, is to understand actuality in terms of self-existing things and their external relations. It's another knowledge program. Can we account for experience if we posit independently existing entities and external relationships among them? That's the program of mechanism, and ultimately of science. Now it fails because any such explanation must be incoherent. But nobody seems to mind that for the last 300 years. Nobody seems to really be bothered by it. Yeah?
Yeah, it's interesting the way you talk about hacking in science. And I've often been struck by the fact that science is this crazy patchwork. You know, the drawn to a specialization, even the people that do want to try and produce a coherent picture tend to be in a small area.
That's right. That's right.
And so overall, there's really no force trying to produce coherence.
That's right. That's
the physicists that try to do it, or just in physics, not
that's biology, right.
biology.
And that is a mark of the deficiency of the mental mutation.
You talk about qualitative versus quantitative different. I'm just trying to get more clear on, like, for instance, the qualitative difference of intelligence. Is it? It's not that you're getting more intelligence. It's just you're getting a better intelligence. Is that what qualitative?
No, qualitative is very simple. A quality is in itself unmeasurable. You can't measure green. Can't measure hunger, can't measure love, right? You can't measure pain. They're just not measurable. But then we manage to find abstractions that we can measure.
Like intensity of green or happiness?
No, you can't measure any of those things, but we find things we can measure, like spatiotemporal things that we can measure, and then we try to account for everything in terms of those things we can measure.
Or we say green is a frequency, but you need the standard thing that is vibrating in order to say that it's a frequency.
Well, the point is, you can say green is a frequency, but clearly it's not. Green is a color.
You can only say it if you posit this thing that is vibrating and say that thing is vibrating and it has green.
That's it. But even if you say that, even if you say there's a vibration, you still haven't said anything about the experience of green.
Yeah.
No theory of vibration can account for the experience of greenness. Period. Right? So there's some interesting relationship between what's measurable and what's experienced. Sorting out that relationship is the key to understanding what science is.
We have this machine that, like, color comes in and it spits out frequencies to tell us its experience.
That's right.
It quantitates its qualitative experience.
The quality is translated into a quantity through the experimental ritual. That's what the experimental ritual is. It's a way of reliably taking a complex situation and turning it into a number.
Mm-hmm. To give another example, though, in the early days of film, I think that there was a Russian guy. He would take a picture, just a still of somebody's face. They would show some part of a movie before that and then after that. And depending what they showed, then they would take the same picture, show some other stuff. Depending on what they showed, the face could look hungry, angry, you know? There's a thing at the De Young Museum outside where you go into this dome, and at night, especially on a cloudy night where there's a little bit of light, they have lights going inside the dome, and there's an opening to the sky. The color of the sky changes.
That's right.
Based on the light. So
that's
green
right.
is not green.
That's right. The association between a color and a frequency is quite arbitrary and has very little to do with perception. Right, where the color is actually a function of context. In fact, certain people, I was talking to Aaron Weiss about this. It's always good to talk to Aaron Weiss. He's just so brilliant. And he was telling me about synesthesia. And he was telling me that certain people, when they read, see certain letters in different colors. So every time they see E, it's green. Every time they see B, it's blue. Right? And so they're reading in Technicolor. Right? Their consciousness has just translated the information differently. Right? So, you know, the association between frequency and color is very, very tenuous.
What about, because science can handle, color theory handles all that context dependent stuff.
Does it?
Yeah, decently, yeah. Not the subjective part, though. It can never touch that, the quality of why is your experience green? So how about, you know, science sees the objectified external stuff, and it's accurate as far as that goes, but then there's a subjective side that it can't touch because it doesn't have any ground to make that.
You can say that, I think that particular way of differentiating subject and object is problematical. It's too trenchant, too clear. They're much more interrelated than that. So the point is, science does construct an objective framework. And that objective framework is interesting and useful, but partial. And so, you know, science works when it can reduce things into that framework, and it doesn't with things that can't be reduced into that framework. So what's objective,
as Kassira would say, what's objective is just that which fits within our shared framework of explanation. That's what it means to be objective. And to be subjective means it doesn't fit into that. That's all the difference is.
Doesn't this move towards measurement require a dualism? It seems like when you're talking about the qualitative and experiential and subjective, it's not dualistic, an experience. But in order to explain it or to measure it, you have to explain it as being dualistic.
What, I'm quite there.
In this way, you have to say that either a body stays the same and moves through an environment that changes, or the environment changes and the body is just a process.
Yeah.
So in science, in each revolution, you have this sort of attempt to say either that there's a split between the foreground and the background, or the body and its environment, the
right.
mind and its subject.
Right.
Quantum physics is trying to locate the subject, it seems, because all this time we've thought the subject is a fixed center in space and everything moves around it, or the other way around. The environment is fixed, and within it there is movement.
And but where's dualism come in? Separation of the pulling out?
To measure is to say interior, exterior, mind, body, before, after. You have to make a split in order to make a measurement.
Well, I don't know, maybe. I mean, it's subtle what you're saying. I'm not quite sure how to respond to it. I have to really think more deeply. Certainly, measurement requires the distinguishing of individual objects.
Yes.
But that goes all the way back to magical, let's say, where measurement was impossible. So, and where it wasn't dualistic, right? So I'm just so dualism is a pretty late stage of human thought that only comes with the mental mutation.
There's a difference between polarity and dualism,
right? And it may be that measurement is only possible in the mental mutation, and therefore it would require dualism. I think that's possible. Yeah, that seems plausible. Good. Yeah, I'm with you. Okay.
You could build all of mathematics on zero and one distinction.
Right.
Basically, if you have a distinction.
Right. Yeah, so it does. Mathematics and objectivity do seem to require dualism. I'm with you on that. Okay, good. Okay, so we've got this idea now of the Earth as being in physical space, permeated by these less dense materials, which extend out beyond the atmosphere, right? So this is the theosophical picture, right? And of course, it's all in this case, it's all three-dimensional space, right? So the same three-dimensional space that Newton articulated as the background for physical process is now established as the background for transphysical process as well. So there's this assumption that three-dimensional space is what's real, right? That what is actual is just what occurs in three-dimensional space, and that if the transphysical worlds are actual, they too must happen in three-dimensional space. And so this fixation on three-dimensional space is held constant in the theosophical translation of the Vedic ideas. With me? It's very interesting to notice what stays the same and what doesn't. So, okay, so this physical space. Now, later on, the theosophists introduce a new idea, the idea of the fourth dimension. Right, so somewhere in the late 1800s, with the publication of Flatland, if you haven't read that book, you should read it, the whole idea of the fourth dimension became popularly interesting to people. And so the theosophists immediately seized upon it, because the fourth dimension becomes a new place we can put the transphysical worlds. Right, the idea that the transphysical worlds occupy three-dimensional space is a little bit crude. So now we say, okay, they occupy a fourth dimension. Right, so this gives us a sense that we can, instead of just seeing that the transphysical worlds go out beyond the Earth in three-dimensional space, they now go beyond the Earth into this extra dimension, the fourth dimension, which somehow becomes a bigger place you can put transphysical worlds in. So this, is a straight extension of physical space. It's still metrical, right? It's still a space defined by parallel lines and right angles. And dimension, in this case, still means a right-angled movement, right? So we have three dimensions of space. Now there's a fourth one, fourth spatial dimension that we we can't visualize, but that's where the transphysical worlds are. Now, again, this idea is inadequate, right? To begin with, whatever is in three-dimensional space is physical. And so all we're doing is expanding the physical world, and we're not really, like, there's no reason to think that our dreams happen in physical space. They don't happen in physical space. It's not like that, you know. Dreams, the connections among things, aren't organized according to three-dimensional spatial principles. There's some other organization of proximity in dreams that's quite different. So there's no reason to think it's three-dimensional. One of the guys at the Esalen conference, Bernard Shaw, his name is, a British guy. He's a theosophist, an old theosophist like me, and also a big name astrophysicist. You know? And so he's got this theory that the transphysical worlds are all happening in higher dimensions. And he has this completely arbitrary scheme that I can't make heads or tails out of, in which for some reason, when you go to the fifth dimension, you get consciousness. What does consciousness have to do with orthogonal dimensions? Why would one orthogonal dimension be different from another orthogonal dimension? It's just totally arbitrary. But this idea, physicists like it because it's a way they can try to express their transphysical intuitions in the language of physics. And these ideas, density, frequency, and higher dimensions, permeate New Age literature. Everywhere you go, people are talking about densities, frequencies, and higher dimensions. Right? Yeah.
And to me, that's the problem with a lot of this thinking, is that science isn't just taking a scientific-sounding concept and, you know, constructing a cosmology based on scientific-sounding concepts, based on whatever we think at the time is scientific-sounding.
That's
and
right.
And then you have a supposedly scientific cosmology.
That's right.
That's just slapping labels on there. There's no clear methodology that it uses that makes some vague appeal to observation.
That's correct.
Because you say, well, how far are you going to get in contemporary scientific literature if you say, well, I did some observation, and then here's my cosmology.
I'm totally with you. This is not scientific because it's immune to experimental verification.
Exactly.
Now, you're absolutely right.
And that's what the New Age does left and right, is that they have no method.
That's right.
They have no social validation process.
That's
correct. They just slap scientific labels on spiritual concepts and think that they've somehow integrated science and religion.
You got it. You are absolutely correct. Everybody listen to Nick.
That's right.
Yeah. Absolutely. But it makes and so this is an better example of that, right? And what?
But it makes me feel better.
Excellent. So glad for you.
Because now I feel like it could be validated with the scientific community, which is...
Well, that's the whole point.
The new theocracy of our...
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, that's why it's done. It's because it makes us feel better. That's it. Okay? That's it. Oh, so let's just know that.
And there's something laudable about it. Like, I'm a big fan of theosophy, so don't get me wrong. I'm deeply inspired by it personally. And I think it's laudable to attempt to, you know, bring together a spiritual cosmology with, you know, how is that related to scientific stuff? But I just don't think they really, it's just an early pioneering attempt that didn't really nail it.
And that's exactly how I'm presenting it.
Yeah.
Exactly, that's what I'm trying to say. This is an early attempt that was very influential but didn't nail it.
Can you say a word again about how we're going to do this differently? Like how we're going to take scientific concepts too and try to use them, but
yes,
we're going to do it in a way that can be validated? Is that the difference?
Or what?
In a way that it can be validated?
You know, not yet. I hope so.
It just keeps coming up in my mind. Here we are talking about how all these other people did it and are doing it. And
right, so
we're going to do the same thing.
Well, we're going to do it better. That's
but
the idea.
Just with the newer ideas.
That's it. I mean, basically,
just the next step.
A next step along the continuum, right? Because that's all we can do as human beings. As mental human beings. Now, here's the thing. I believe, maybe even I know, I don't know, that human beings are capable of actual functioning in transphysical worlds. I know that to be the case. As much as I know anything, I know that human beings can function and function lucidly in transphysical worlds. And I know that human beings are, each and every one of us, God, expressing itself in a finite form. And that we can come to know that. And that, in fact, as we come to know ourselves as the divine, We come to know everything by being one with it. So human knowledge, the possibilities of human knowledge vastly transcend the possibilities of the intellect. For sure. But here we are at this particular stage of our evolution, where we're thinkers, right? And so at this stage, we think. And we try to think in such a way that it allows us to move beyond thought into more satisfying modes of knowledge. And, you know, I got an email from a close friend of mine who's in the Santo Daime. You guys know what the Santo Daime is? It's a Brazilian religion based around ayahuasca as a sacrament. It's a very interesting astral religion. You know, they work hard at taking their drug and going off into the astral world and contacting dead people and all kinds of interesting stuff they do, right? And it's a religion, and it's a real valid religious movement that's actually growing quite a bit, and it's a very important 21st century phenomenon, in itself. One of my friends is a religion scholar, and he's been actively in Santo Daime. He got this letter yesterday. He's describing to me his experiences on an ayahuasca journey, you know, and going off into the transphysical worlds, and he goes on and on, these incredible experiences he can gather. Remember, you know, many of us have had those kinds of experiences. And I realized that I don't actually want to do that anymore, because what I'm really interested in is not leaving the waking world and going somewhere else, but what I'm interested in is restructuring the waking world so it becomes transparent to those other realities. Right? And so instead of sort of leaping over the waking consciousness using the sacred substances, I'm interested in working my way through the waking world so it can be reconstructed in a way that opens it up. It's a different kind of fantasy, a different project, a different knowledge project.
There are people, though, who have taken, I mean, so yeah, if we just look at the philosophical or let's say the religious dimensions of this, it leads in certain directions, but then there are people in, say, the realm of healing who have actually tried to apply these
Absolutely.
Kinds of insights.
That's great.
And I think that there's, you know, that it's possible to do observation, I don't know if measurement is the right word, but for example, we were talking today in the study group about this whole notion of ideas kind of being around, you know, when you're walking down the street, there are all these ideas with associate. Well, there's a flower essence called Mountain Pennyroyal. And the purpose of that flower essence is to protect the person who takes it from untoward influence of, you know, what you might call negative vibes.
Right.
But, you know, these negative ideas. And I've taken it, and it seems to work. And, you know, as long as, I mean, if you kind of construct a causal chain of like, well, okay, there's, you know, is there an astral world? How do we determine whether that's what's going on here? Is it ideas? Is it energy? But it seems to me that there are ways to look at this stuff in the realm of healing in particular. Maybe there are other realms
as well. Absolutely.
Where you can actually start to put this stuff together in the direction that I think you're talking about.
I don't see why you're saying it as if it's contradicting something I'm saying.
Well, no, I guess it's like I'm not sure what I'm.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is very simple. I'm not denying the transpositional.
No, right.
I'm not denying their pragmatic usefulness. I'm just making a technical distinction. I'm just saying we have one of the ways that we have at our disposal for exploring the transphysical domains is through sacred substances, and a lot of people in this program are doing that. I've done a lot of it. It's very interesting. I'm not saying anything bad about it at all. I'm just saying that I noticed that I'm interested in something else. I'm not interested at this point in traveling. And one of the things my friend was talking about is how difficult it is to bring the memories back. Like he said, he was out there in the transphysical world having these incredible experiences and describing them to himself as he had them, knowing he wouldn't be able to remember them when he came back. Right, so I'm interested in opening up the waking world so it's more transparent to the transphysical world. And part of that is having a way of thinking that lets us think naturally about them. That should make it a lot easier to remember them when we wake up. Right, so my specific interest is not so much in traveling as in opening up the waking world so that there's a more transparent flow back and forth. Right? So that instead of it being, we're either here or we're high, it's that the whole high world is permeating this world and we're aware of it and functioning consciously in relation to it.
And there is a flower essence for that too. I'm not going to get too up. But mugwort is a flower.
I'll try some.
But anyway, yeah, I'll get you some.
Okay, good.
One of the things that's really interesting to me about Astroworld, what you're describing and so forth, is it doesn't exist in, for example, the spiritual path I'm on, the Dharma approach. And you would know maybe better than me. I don't know if it's in Buddhism or Kabbalah. It's like you go straight to the ground of
This is historical. This is historical. For example, if you go back into the early Buddhist texts, I was reading the Visuddhimagga, which is a medieval compilation of Buddhist wisdom from Sri Lanka. Very interesting book. And they describe all the transphysical worlds in there, and they describe how they're reached through various stages of meditative absorption. And there are stories, you know, some guy's hanging out in his meditative state, he thinks he's really cool, and then his teacher comes along and says, "You're hanging out down here? This is ridiculous," you know, and like that, right? So the transphysical worlds are an intrinsic part of Vedic cosmology, and were never questioned by Buddhism, particularly, or by Hinduism. But what happened was, people got really impatient. This is what Sri Aurobindo says, right? And they started thinking, this whole world is nothing but a veil of tears. And so, accomplishing anything in this world is a waste of time. What you want to do is you want to commit noble suicide so thoroughly that you're never reborn. I mean, really, the highest ideal of early Buddhism is radical suicide. Really, right? They say, where does the saint go after he's enlightened? Where does a candle go after it's blown out?
Right, which is a lot of the premise that I was going at when I did psychedelics some of the times.
Going for the unconditioned?
Yeah.
Right, so Sri Aurobindo says, well, yeah, you can do that, and that works, right? And so all the traditions began to say, as you meditate, you will have experience of the transphysical worlds, and you will have the experience of the cities, but for your own good, you'd better ignore all that and pretend it's not happening so you can just go straight for nirvana. It's just a trip, right? Sri Aurobindo says, that's terrible, that's ridiculous waste, you know? It's like, this is all really important stuff, it's part of the world, we should explore it, and in fact, if we can function consciously on the transphysical worlds, we can access non-dual states much more effectively, and so forth.
Eric, can you elucidate noble suicide? I'm not familiar with that.
So well, the idea of Buddhism, early Buddhism, is that the ego is a self-perpetuating error. And so there really is no ego, and there really is no self, but there's the illusion of a self, which is very painful. And so the best thing you can do is to cut through the illusion of self by eliminating desire and ignorance. And after that, you're released from illusion, which means you no longer exist, period. And no longer existing, cessation, nirodha, absolute cessation is the highest ideal for early Buddhism. It's totally world-denying.
So even though you're still functioning physiologically, you're...
Well, that's a big embarrassment to them. It was a big embarrassment to them that after enlightenment, people still functioned physiologically. It really messed up their theory. So they said, well, that's just karma, and your bodily karma has to play itself out. But after you're enlightened, your body dies, then you never come back.
If you're enlightened, wouldn't that also cease karma?
But yeah, after that, you're going
to
make choices.
Karma has to play itself out as your body is finishing its life. Right. Something like that. I mean, so I'm not advocating any of these theories. What I'm trying to point out to you is that when people get a certain theoretical position, they draw really radical consequences from it, and then we live with those consequences, right? So for the last several thousand years, our civilization has been dominated by the idea that this is shit, that's great, and we should ignore all the shit and go up there. Right? And so that's conditioned all these texts that have been written, and it was a fashion. It was a fashionable idea for the last couple thousand years, and now it's going out of fashion, which is good, because it's not a very interesting idea for us. Make sense? Okay. Linda.
So with making the transphysical worlds more transparent in our waking world so that we can get information back and forth more easily, that's something that some people can already do.
Yeah.
Right? Like, for example, Jung. would that be an example of him being able to go into his fantasy
world? Or Natalie, who's a psychic and does these things, right? So, yeah.
So this is just, okay.
But the question is, see, the thing is, we can do it, but we need a theory. And we need a theory partly because we need to make this no longer some weird woo-woo trip that they do in California, but it needs to become central to our science and our civilization. And we can't do that without a theory. Right? So that's why we need a theory. That makes sense? And also, it's not just that. Because right now, the access that we do have to the transphysical worlds is vague and murky. Right. We're not really sure, you know. Like we all close our eyes, and some of us are more sensitive, and we see pictures or feel things in our bodies, right? But then we have to translate it, and the translation process is always risky. And then different people see different things, and it's not quite clear how much is subjective and how much is objective. And I used to live with a psychic for a while, and I watched her do a lot of readings, and she was pretty good. But here's what she would do: somebody would come in, and they'd ask a question. And she would just start making shit up. I swear. Right? And then what would happen? So I'd listen to her. She's making shit up. And then all of a sudden, usually about 10 minutes in, something would happen. And it wouldn't be made up anymore. She didn't know the difference. I could tell. I could feel the difference. Like she had sort of clicked into the trance. And then the quality of her talking changed. It wasn't being made up anymore. It was being channeled. But she didn't know the difference. Right? It's really interesting. So we need criteria for what's valid psychic insight, what's pure imagination, how do we tell shit from shinola, right? And the only way to do that is to have some theory of what's objectively real in transphysical domains, right? And also, because the language that we use is so hostile to transphysical entities, it makes it very difficult for us to bring back the memories of our transphysical experiences. But if we start speaking in a way which is transparent to those realities, then they're going to become easier to remember and easier to integrate. Make sense?
Can you give an example of that?
I can give the opposite example.
Great.
Which is where you start thinking that you're saying things that make sense to you, but they don't make sense to other people.
Yeah, well, maybe, but... Okay, but I want to go... Nick's question a little more precise. Say it again.
I was just asking if you'd give an example.
An example? Well, I know... Okay, a couple mornings ago, I was having some dream that involved the unification of concepts. And I had these two different concepts in the dream, and they were all very elaborately interconnected. I was tracking all this, right? And then I woke up, and that's all I remember, right? So somehow the categories that I use in my waking life aren't complex or subtle enough to allow me to express what I remember. And so it all gets lost except what I can fit into language. Now, one of the keys to dream recall, when I was really actively working on my dream memory, I would wake up and tell myself the dream in words. And that way, in the morning, I'd remember the words, and the words would bring back the dream. But only a fraction of what I'm experiencing in the dream can get into the words, because the words don't have the categories. Right? There are spatial, temporal, causal relations, resonant relations in the astral world that are simply more complex and intricate than my waking language can express. But if we develop a more complex and adequate waking language, it might allow us to express a lot more of the dream experience and therefore make it more coherently interrelated with waking life.
No,
I want to talk scholar then Bill.
Okay. I feel like you're making an assumption by saying it has to be done through language. I mean, in order to be congruent throughout experience, yes, but I think that there's a lot of people that are very good at doing communicating not through language.
I'm not claiming that my method is the be-all and the end-all. There are lots of different things going on here. I've just got one specific project,
And this specific project is a philosophical project of educating our language to make it more transparent to the transphysical. I'm not claiming you have to do that. I do think it's important on a social basis that if we're going to do more than just have our own individual experiences, and if we're going to fully participate in the crystallization and embodiment of integral consciousness, we need to modify our language to make that possible. And that's what that's the project I've chosen to work on.
Well, isn't language part of the mental, though? So
no, language is way before the mental. Language goes back to the magical.
Okay.
I mean, there is some mentality involved in all language, for sure.
I thought I had a memory of you once saying something like, when we're in the integral, then it'll be like communication on a psychic level, or like without words.
I never said that because I hope I didn't say it. I might have. But the...
That's what a lot of near-death experience is described to be, though.
Like, do you think we can develop a complex enough language that we could be able to successfully...
Because the language doesn't give you experience. You first need experience, and the experience causes you to make the language, but you cannot make it differently.
That's not entirely true. It goes both ways, because a shift in language permits a shift in experience.
Yes, but in order to be able to make this shift in language, you have to have some sample of the experience you are going to experience after you fully grasp the language.
I am not trying to make language autonomous. Mm. Language is always related to the process of abstraction from experience. Never stands by itself. I agree with you.
I just wanted to polarize that the primary is the experience. After you have the experience and you have it in lucid daily experience, while you are really in this world, or this outer layer of reality, then you are able, and you will be able, to name the experience that you are experiencing.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite following.
No, just my reaction that we need first to make the language, but if you do not have first the method how to gain the experience, to see certain realities, we are not able to make the language because it will be abstraction that will have nothing to do.
There are two different things. I think that we need to be very, very sensitive to the relationship between language and experience. And it's quite subtle and not easy to disentangle. But it is clear to me that the world in which we live in is in large parts imagined. Right, so we imagine the solar system. We have no experience of the solar system. We imagine it, right? And we imagine the Big Bang, right? And we imagine that objects exist even when we're not looking at them, right? So when I go home and open my drawer next to my dresser, I expect to find my pill bottle in there. I think it's there right now, but how do I know? I can't see it, right? It's an imagination, right? And so we complete our world with a great deal of imagination. And last week, I spent a lot of time on studying the visual field. Remember that? And how the visual field is quantized. Didn't we do this last time? Yeah. And how, even though we have these different quanta of vision, we assemble them into a geometrical picture, because the geometry is an idea we have in our minds that lets us assemble things. Right? So we have this geometrical idea about reality, and then we say whatever fits into the geometry is actual, whatever doesn't isn't actual. Right? So this is linguistic. Right? In some way, we've linguistically defined a space, and then it allows us to sort our perceptions in a certain way, which we call the physical world, which is an abstraction from experience based on language in some important sense, as Kassir tries to demonstrate. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen without language, but language conditions it in the human space very powerfully. Now, if my suggestion is that if, for example, we're able to look at non-metrical geometries, non-Euclidean geometries and non-metrical geometries, projective geometries, and so forth. I got this from Steiner, by the way. Steiner gave this idea to me. Steiner writes a book called How to Access Mystical States, or it's
higher worlds.
What?
How to access the higher worlds.
How to access the higher worlds. A very interesting book. And at the end of it, what he starts to say is that in order to access the higher worlds, we have to think in terms of projective geometry. Now, I never quite understood how he was doing it. I never quite got what they were doing. But the idea that if we think about the world with a different geometry, it reveals itself differently. It's very powerful. And so I've been working on this. Like I've been working on Whitehead's ideas and working on new ideas about how space and time work. So I've been shifting the language. And I find that as I'm thinking in this new language, my experience is starting to shift.
It helps you to focus at the reality you want to perceive, but it is just...
I agree with you. It's a focusing technique. I'm not saying language comes first, and I'm not saying language exists independently. There's always this cycle between us and the world that language figures in some important way, and that by changing our language, we change our reality. We change our experienced reality when we change our language. That's my point. Okay. Caleb.
I use astrological language, and that really opened up for me more perception into
exactly
to read because it's a relationships of different states and
right. The point is the language opens up a new way of experiencing reality. Many of us who've recently learned astrology have had that experience.
My concern is that a lot of features of our everyday language close us to our recollection of these experiences.
That's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying.
So then how do we determine what parts of our language need to disappear in order for us
through metaphysical analysis. Okay. That's the point, right? So I'm going to, starting next week, we're going to start proposing a whole new metaphysical language, which I think will... See, you asked about the difference in approach, right? Like, what I'm going to do is propose a metaphysical language which will account both for science and for the transphysical worlds. So I'm not trying to account for the transphysical worlds in terms of science. I'm trying to account for both science and the transphysical worlds as they happen in experience. So here's what I want to do. This is a good segue. Let's take a break, and then we're done with Ledbetter for today, and we come back to Ledbetter. Okay, is anybody recording today?
You, Vladimir is.
Yes. Vladimir is.
I just started it for him.
Okay,
great.
No, Vladimir is recording. I'll get it from him. Okay. I'm a little betwixt in between here. Okay. So we're going to talk about I want to introduce a new approach that I'm advocating for. And I want to start by talking about the concrete and the abstract. Now, have we talked about that much in this class? No? Okay. So this distinction is an extremely important distinction. It's certainly important in the mental mutation, but I believe it's important in all human experience. And it's a distinction between the concrete and the abstract. Now, I am introducing this term concrete as a technical term, which means that you have to forget what you think the word means. Right, because the word concrete in English has come to take on connotations that come from the substance concrete, right? And so we think of what's concrete as being solid and dense and obvious and particular and so forth, right? But I am not going to use the word in that sense. I'm going to use the word concrete as the opposite of abstract. So we have the abstract and the concrete. And I'm using it this way because Whitehead uses it this way and because I don't have a better word for it at the moment. And so I'm going to use Whitehead's word, even though it's not the way it's used in ordinary English. You with me? Okay. So the concrete is the full, the complex, the actual. If you want it right now, what's concrete? Your experience is concrete. Your moment of existing is a concrete actuality. It's real. And then, from that experience, we begin to make abstractions. We begin to pull things out of the background and highlight them in our awareness. And we do that by means of abstraction. Right? So abstractions are ideas. Right? Abstractions are forms. They're what Whitehead calls forms of definiteness. Forms of definiteness. In other words, there are, the way the universe is set up, there are certain ways in which things can be definite. For example, things can have colors. And if they have a color, there's a spectrum of colors they can have. And so those are, every color is a specific form of determinateness. Right? Chartreuse is a form of determinateness. It's a way things can be. It's a way things can have a character. So there are events in the world. There are things that happen. And then those things have character. Right? And the character that things have is their way of being definite. And so the way Whitehead talks about it, he says the possibilities or the abstractions, which he calls the eternal objects, have ingression, they ingress, they become ingredients in events. So a particular event will have green and round and hard ingredient in it. And it's a jade bead. So a jade bead has greenness in it, hardness in it, right, and roundness in it. So those are the forms of definiteness that it has. And so the concrete is always the source from which the abstractions are drawn. In a sense, the concrete includes the abstractions, but a consciousness can pull them out and elicit them into relevance. Vladimir.
So it is synonymous to the medieval distinction between universals in itself and in the objects and apart from the object.
It's similar, but yeah, not exactly the same, because the word universal has certain connotations to it that Whitehead doesn't want to use, but it's a subtle distinction, and I've forgotten exactly why it's different. But yes, but it's just there are subtle differences in the way Whitehead uses it. But yes, you've got the idea, for sure. Okay? Universals in particular is one way of talking about this. The universals are the abstractions, the particulars are the things that are characterized by the universals. It's an old distinction. It's a distinction that's at the base of all Western philosophy. All Western philosophy begins with this. This is substance and form, right? Actuality and idea. And so all Western thinking begins with this discrimination of the idea from that in which the idea is ingredient. The idea is eternal, which is quite interesting, right? So let's say we have a particular shade of color. We have exactly the green that you see. Go ahead and be subjective. The green that you see here on the cup is a particular shade of green. Very, very precise, right? And it's exactly what it is. And so you could say, I remember having seen that same shade of green 3 weeks ago. And I anticipate painting something with that shade of green 3 weeks from now. But the shade of green never changes. It's the same every time you think about it. And so these ideas never change, even though the things in which they're ingredient are changing. You follow me? And so this is what blew Plato away, right there.
And there are a lot of passages, for example, in Sophist where he contradicts. There are a lot of passages.
Yes.
For example, in his Sophist.
Yes.
Where he defines ideas differently. He does not define them like static.
Okay.
Or unmovable. So
as unmovable.
Well, in generally speaking, Greek philosophy is characterized by the idea that the forms.
Generally speaking, but it is not.
Okay, I haven't read the Sophist, and I don't know what he does there. I'd like to know.
I'll find the passage.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. So, in any case, the general idea, which Vladimir is telling me is too simple, is that the eternal object, like the shade of green, is always the same shade of green, and that square is the same. Even though no two squares are alike, squareness is the same whenever you see it. See that, right? And so Plato was overwhelmed by this revelation that there are permanent forms of order that hold their coherency in some way distinct from the phenomenal world from which they can be abstracted. Science still has this. There's the natural laws, which are permanent, and then there's the flow of events. Right? So the only difference between science and Plato is that science only recognizes mathematical forms as being valid and ignores all the others. So there's no form of the good in science, no form of the beautiful, right? No form of consciousness, it's just mathematical forms. But you still get form and matter. That's the whole thing. Right? All Western philosophy, all Western thought revolves around the distinction between the eternal forms and the fluent material in which they're instantiated. Okay, concrete and abstract. Now, our civilization is committed to a project of explanation which begins in the abstract and works back to the concrete. Right? So, for example, we think the world isn't really a world of human experience. The world is really a world of energies progressing according to mathematical laws. That's the real world, right? That's abstract. I mean, mathematics is very highly abstract. Laws are very highly abstract. The idea of matter is an incredibly abstract idea, which doesn't actually correspond to anything in experience in any close way, right? And so, but then we have this set of abstractions that we call the physical world, and then we try to account for our experience starting with the abstractions, right? So we say, okay, the energy out there and the mathematical laws are real, but our experience is derivative from it, right? And so almost all the time we do this, like you know, the whole universe story says the universe is evolving. We know that objectively. That's an abstraction. And then human beings are a certain kind of participant in the evolutionary process. So it starts with the abstract, the evolution, and then comes back to the concrete, the human. You see what I'm saying? Right? And so our whole culture is committed to this project of setting up a set of abstractions and then trying to account for our experience in terms of the abstractions. But it turns out that the abstractions are drawn from experience. That's what it means to say science is empirical. They forget that, right? But the point is that scientific thought is supposed to be grounded in experience. That's why it's empirical, right? So it makes, I'm suggesting it would make a lot more sense to start from the concrete and to explain the abstract than it does to start with the abstract to explain the concrete. It's a Humpty Dumpty problem, right? Once it's fractured into the abstractions, you can never put it all back together. And yet originally, it was all together in experience. And so there's two fundamental different knowledge projects, one of which starts from the abstract to account for the concrete, and one starts with the concrete and accounts for the abstract. Whitehead's really clear about that. He says, we think that the job of philosophy is to account for the concrete, but that's upside down. All philosophy starts with the concrete and accounts for the abstract. Now, so let me bring this down to something a little more concrete and real, the other sense of concrete. Let me bring this down to something more pragmatic. We want to know something. You want to have a sense that we know something. And that out of this bewildering flux of successive experiences that we live through, we want to feel that there is something that holds still. That there's some pattern or some key that will unlock the flow of experience. And so we can begin to understand the flow of experience against an unchanging background. Right? We all really crave that. Right? We want to feel like we know where we are. We want to get oriented. And to be oriented, we have to be oriented to that which doesn't change as experience unfolds. That makes sense. Right? And we're always trying to achieve that in the various mutations of consciousness. We're trying to achieve some sense of a stable environment within which we can make sense of the flow of the change. That's what all human understanding is about. Right?
Okay, we want to understand, where do we find the reference points? Where do we put our foot down? Where do we say, this I believe, this is a fixed point of reference, and I can construct experience around this fixed point of reference? Where do we find that? Science tries to find it in the performance of experiment rituals. Right? The fact that the performance of experiment rituals can be so designed that they give the same answer each time becomes the foundation pillar. The experiments become the pillars around which we erect an image of the world. Right? But as I've been trying to suggest, then we end up constructing a world out of our imagination. Right? And we begin to realize that the scientific reality is a projection of our own methods in some important sense. So if we're not going to ground our story there, where are we going to start it? And what I want to suggest is that the story has to start here. Right here. Exactly where you are at this moment. That's where the story has to start. And the basic premise of all the philosophical work I'm doing is that your existence in this moment is a perfectly valid example of what it means to be a real being. That you are real. And that you are more real than an atom. Because an atom is an abstraction from your experience. Right? Everything starts with experience. And then we divide the field of experience up in different ways. And as we do that, we begin to construct worlds out of our experience. But they all come out of our experience. Everything starts here. Right? So there's a completely different approach than science. Science starts there to try to derive here. I'm starting here to try to derive there. And I suggest this is a superior procedure, right? Because really, the only point of reference we can find is our own experience.
How's it different, this procedure different from the phenomenological procedure?
Let me think about that a minute. It's a complicated question.
Initially, it's not different.
It's a kind of phenomenology.
It's a kind of phenomenological approach. Yeah, although the phenomenological approach doesn't have any ontological aspirations. I do. Okay. So that's the only difference. But I'm starting from a phenomenological point of view. I'm saying, let's just describe experience because that's what's real. Yeah.
Starting with the abstract, it seems that the abstract's common to everyone, whereas like when you start with experience, it's your experience, which is not my experience. So that seems to be the problem is, how do we correspond our experiences? How do we create a coherency of experience?
That's exactly right. That's the problem. Right. Now, and that's a big problem. And there's a lot to say about it. But you're right, you've identified the problem. But this starting point raises that problem.
Oh.
Okay? So that's right. So if we start here, we have to say, where does the objectivity of the world come from if everything is rooted in experience? So when we start with raw experience, we're doing a phenomenology, right? But phenomenology, although it pretends to get beyond metaphysics, I would say it cannot do so. And the reason is because it's one thing to examine experience. That doesn't necessarily require ideas. But to describe experience always requires ideas. Right? Because language is always a concatenation of abstractions. Every word stands for an abstraction, and so language is a concatenation of abstractions. And so once you begin describing experience, you have to have a language, and the language has to be a set of abstractions in terms of which you're making sense of the world, right? So there really is no such thing as phenomenology that's not metaphysical. Once you use descriptive language, you're doing metaphysics. And then the question is, what is the descriptive language that we should use in describing our experience. And Whitehead suggests that we should base our language on the distinction between the concrete and the abstract. And so in experience, he says, we can differentiate the primordial differentiation that we make in experience, he says, is the distinction between events and what he calls objects, which are really ideas or eternal objects or forms. So there's events and forms. So in our experience, as we look around and try to describe it, we can begin to distinguish separable events. Each one of you is an event, in this moment, is an event in the field of my experience. You're a happening. Each one of you is happening for me, right? And also, each one of you is differentiated from the others by your character, by the way in which you are definitely you. Right? So in my perceptual field, I notice events and I notice objects or ideas. And Whitehead says, this should be the primordial language with which we approach reality. Events and ideas. This is the primordial distinction. Also goes back to Plato. Whitehead says, all of Western philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato. And this is part of the reason. One of the reasons he says that is because it always refers back to this distinction between the form and substance, between events and ideas.
But how do we determine that the distinction is concrete? Because I thought we said that abstraction or distinction is abstraction. Definition is abstraction.
That's right. So we're abstracting, right? Yeah. Right. So what's the question?
How can we tell what part of the definition comes before the abstraction?
In other words, to what extent are the abstractions there to be abstracted, or are they invented by us?
Yeah. Well, part. Which part is? Which part isn't? Yeah. If it's part and part.
That is a really excellent question, and I'm thinking a lot about it because I've been learning the Kantian tradition, and in the Kantian tradition, the idea seems. The understanding is that we make up the ideas, that they're just free mental creations, and then we sort of analyze the world in terms of them. But in the Whiteheadian position, which I'm also taking, they really are there in the world, and we abstract them from the world, which is why they're veridical. Okay?
We abstract ideas?
Yeah. From, you know, this is concrete. Capital T, right? And then out of it, I abstract people and chairs and, right?
Oh, I see, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, go.
So, confused between the, language as an example of a system of abstraction or a tool for it. When you say abstract from, so it's inherent in experience in some sense, but also it's internal form. I'm being too complicated. Simple thing. Okay, there's a certain sense in which language and ideas come from experience.
Mm-hmm.
A certain sense where they're already there. And then there's a sense in which, once we get a set of abstractions, we can start to play with them in ways that does not come from experience.
Mm-hmm.
So we have imagination. So
mm-hmm.
I'm confused about the... connection. Like in science, you create hypotheses in the mind as if you have no connection with the world, and then you test to see if they're there.
Right.
So how can language at once be free imagination and also derived from something?
Good question. I don't think you're confused at all. I think you're asking the right question. It's confusing. I'm struggling with this myself. Right? This is it. This is the confusion, the relationship between ideas and events and how that works, right? And so I'm just swimming in this all the time lately, because I thought I had it all figured out with Whitehead, but then I got to Sear, and now my thinking is completely in disarray around it. So it's a great question, and the distinctions you're making between those three things that you said, those are great distinctions.
Damn, I thought you had an answer.
I mean, I could try, right? But I'd have to really.
Yeah.
I think it's more important to celebrate your question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, you cannot do this without Vipassana approach.
What?
You cannot do this. You are not able to work so sharply and so fast with the mind to distinguish all these qualities, whether you make them or whether they are really there, without you mentioned that you practice Vipassana.
But Vipassana is maybe a way of allowing us to more clearly uncover the process of reality creation or appearance creation. I agree. We need some kind of method like that. And philosophy rests on some kind of informal method like that, some sort of introspective method. And it may indeed turn out that Vipassana is a great philosophical tool. It needs to be more specifically cultivated.
But in order for it to be effective, You have to practice it constantly. It is not a matter that you will pay attention to these problems at this class.
Well, I mean, you're telling me that Vipassana is a great practice. I agree, but I'm not quite sure the point you're making here.
Well, if all of us do not practice constantly, we won't be able to understand each other, because we won't be able to have the same experience.
Well, you know, there's a kind of fascist Buddhism that's going around, which seems to think that the methods of Buddhist meditation are absolutely required for the full human existence, and I simply reject it. Vipassana is a great method, and it does a lot, and I've played with it, I've worked with it for years and so forth, but I don't claim it's to be all and the end all. I don't think everybody needs to do it all the time, and I'm just not prepared to make that kind of statement. I think that's just fascist. I just don't like it. Right? I just think there's a lot of ways to exist and a lot of ways to explore reality, and Vipassana is one of them, and it's an important and interesting way, but I won't say we can't understand each other unless we're all practicing Vipassana. I'm just not going to go there.
What about a consistent spiritual practice of some sort?
I'm not going to make any such pronouncement at this point. I consider philosophy to be a spiritual practice.
I have a philosophical question that sort of relates to this. If the phenomenological report requires you to put the brackets back, to bring the distinctions back in, then can we figure out phenomenologically where the brackets come from? Like, if I have to stop the experiment in order to tell you what I've seen, then how do I uncover the process of, how do I fit me telling what I've seen, the defining, into the experiment? How do I basically see the abstract in the concrete?
That's how you do it. You just did it. Now you got to spell it out.
Right?
Yeah. There it is. I don't know the answer. I mean, this is the question, right? We're dealing with the fundamental texture of experience, right? And it clearly involves abstraction. This is what Whitehead calls conceptual prehension. There's got to be abstraction or we can't make sense of it. And there's got to also be direct experience of other reality. And there's got to be a relationship between them, right? That is the most mysterious thing in the universe, as far as I'm concerned, right? The relationship between the ideas and the actuality. Oh my God, I spent all my time thinking about it lately, right? How does that work, right? And so I loved your question, and you've already done it. Right? You've now said, okay, now I'm going to step back, and I'm going to bracket the whole process of objectification as something that's in my experience and try to describe it.
Yes.
That's what we're doing here.
But I feel like the question suggests that it's impossible to actually finish the experience.
It is. I think it is. I think because...
Or this might be more productive. Is there a form of language that is the expression of process and not the expression of states and definitions, but like you said, eternal objects. Can we talk about what would the opposite be? Finite objects or objects in process, objects in transition?
Sorry, I thought I was taking it outside. It was off, but it must have gotten that's all wrong.
Now I know what kind of music you like.
If what we're doing with most of our language is throwing around abstractions, which are eternal objects, which we understand them because they stay the same, their definitions, their things, and we can sort of say, all right, that's a dog, that's water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. If we're saying that in reality, in concrete experience, there aren't these eternal objects. They're more of relationships or
I never said they weren't there. I never said eternal objects weren't there in experience. They are there in experience. They have to be there in experience.
Okay.
That's a question of how we elicit them into relevance for our own experience individually. But they're there. They have to be there. And yet, they're all there in an odd sense because no set of abstractions is rich enough to encompass the complexity and richness of the real world. They're all simplifications. Unfortunately, that's all we can deal with right now. Right? So that's what we do. We create simplified models and then push them as far as we can until they break. And then we try to create better models. That's what we're doing at this stage of our evolution. Right? And so I believe that there are languages that are more or less suited to the actuality that we're living in. And that this changes at different periods, probably. But that right now, we need a new language, which, as you said, is much more transparent to process and to interrelationality. Right? So we need to move our language and our thinking from substance categories to process categories. That's what we're trying to do here in this class. That's the whole point. Yeah.
Well, in another dimension to this, if you want to look at another orthogonal kind of branching out from this, is that it's also not just about intellectualization in the way that we're accustomed to doing via ordinary human speech, ordinary human language. It's like, I mean, I'm still trying to understand what question you guys are asking, but to the extent that I understand it, it's a question of, like, on some level, it's also a question of how do we best share, transmit experience in a certain way.
That's right.
And it's like the emotion has to come into that. Experience has emotion as a really important component
of
it. And emotion can be conveyed through language, but it's not always the best way to do so.
Yeah.
And by the same token, even if language is normally the best way to convey intellectual concepts, it's not always the best way to do so. So we had the dance that Hannah Romanofsky did mm-hmm. about the, right. the different, you know. So to me it's like, or that painting. You know, there's stuff that's being communicated by that. So to me it's like, it, you know, we have to enter into the artistic realm in some way that I don't yet understand in order to make this kind of process, in order to make the rubber meet the road, so to speak, where we're human beings and our experience is conditioned by the fact that we're emotional, we have eyes, we have ears, you know, things like that. So that it's not simply a question of language per se, although the questions that you're asking about how to use language for at least part of that seems to me to be very important. So I'm just trying to say, like, I don't think it can be restricted to language because there are dimensions to it that may not.
What do you think I'm trying to say here?
I'm not sure.
Well, you know, people are uncomfortable with what I'm trying to say, but I'm not sure anybody knows what I'm trying to say. I'm a little bewildered here. Like I'm not really understanding the questions that are coming back because I don't really feel understood in what I'm saying. I'm a little lost. I'm obviously not making myself clear. Let me try it again. I'm trying to say this very simply, and then you can tell me why it doesn't make sense. Okay. I'm saying that the language that we use is a very important element in the way that we constitute our experience. Right? Because every word is a way of sorting out the universe into classes, right? And if we sort the universe into different kinds of classes, we get a different sort of universe. And then we also have words that describe the relationships between classes, and if we use different kinds of relationships, we'll come up with a different kind of universe. Right? So what I'm trying to say is that in human life, which is what we're primarily interested in this class, right? I mean, we're interested in how the whole universe works because we want to understand what we are. That's the point. Philosophy is the attempt of a linguistic community to account for itself. Right? So
we find ourselves in a linguistic community, and then we say, and we use language and say, what the hell's going on here? And then philosophy is an attempt to answer that question. So we're trying to describe ourselves to ourselves, and if we look into history, it becomes clear that the language that we use and the reality that we inhabit are very closely correlated. Now, language does not stand on its own, nor does logic stand on its own. Right? We're talking about a sequence of experiences. And every experience is concrete, which means every experience involves purpose, valuation, appreciation, anticipation, decision. All the things that make reality real are involved in every single moment. But in that whole flow of experience, which we'll be describing in the metaphysics that we're going to be doing, in the human realm, language plays a very important part. I'm not trying to isolate language out of everything else. In human experience, language, in fact, I would say language defines human experience. Right? The world as we experience it as speakers is the human world. Because language involves a whole transformation of perception. To just utter a word, let's say the word tree. Before the word tree was first uttered, there was no such thing as a tree. There was that thing over there that has shade, and that thing over there that has fruit, but there was no such thing as a tree. Tree is a human category, right? And the human category of tree is partially arbitrary in the sense that it corresponds to human interests and human aims and human needs. It's not objective, it's sort of a creation. The word tree is a creation of people. It's a cultural creation. Right? And yet we now live in a world of trees, and windows, and floors, and buildings. Every single one of those words is a human invention. Not that there aren't real things that we're categorizing, but the categories are human inventions. They partially correspond to what's out there, but not totally. They're interesting, but they're not absolute. And then once we have words, we start to live in a world of things, and the things are what fits in the word. Now I have the word tree, and so all these things that used to be separate entities are now in some sense the same kind of thing. Language does that. Right? The human world, the human experience is transfigured by the linguistic operation. Now, the relationship between human language and earlier forms of being is vexing. It needs to be worked out, and a lot of people are thinking about it. But the point is that in the human world, language transforms our experience. And then we see how, after the Renaissance, the cultural construction of perspective and the language that evolved out of that changed our experience of the world. Right? Before the Greeks, we lived in a world of dream. Right? The world is a dream, actually. And when we were in the mythic period, we saw that. Right? So that the world was not analyzed in terms of space, time, and cause. The world was analyzed in terms of meaning and resonance. Different categories, right? In the mythic world, it's about persons, resonances, living beings, polarities. It's a whole other language, a whole other set of abstractions. And they lived in a different world. And then when human beings started to abstract ideas out of gods and goddesses and started to think about time as linear, we entered the three-dimensional world, and space opened up for the first time. And so our experience of space as an expanse is a result of a different way of thinking. Now, it's not just a way of thinking. A mutation of consciousness is not caused by a shift in language. I'm not trying to suggest that. But it does bring about a shift in language.
And so what I'm trying to do is consciously cooperate with our movement into the integral by trying to work out a language that's an integral language for describing reality. Right? So that's all I'm saying. I'm saying that in human experience, language is constitutive of the world that we experience. That the world that we actually live in, pragmatically, the physical world where we drive our cars and stuff, right, is in some sense a cultural construct. It's a particular way of abstracting out of reality certain features and making them important, and then ignoring other features of reality, right? And so it creates this lived world. The human world that we experience would be impossible without language. Right? Somehow, whatever language is, the mysterious function of language, it creates a human world. Any feeling for that?
Yeah.
Right? And so now, knowing that language is central in this way, I'm not saying language creates anything exactly, right? But I'm saying that the function of language is somehow constitutive of what it means to be human, and that when we think linguistically, we transform our experience, and if we change the concepts in terms of which we think, we change the world that we live in. So right now, for example, lots of things like empathy and telepathy and out-of-body experience are barely expressible to us, and so we remain a despised subculture. Right, marginalized, because the things that we're experiencing are not describable in the language that people are using to construct their reality. So we need a new language, right? And the language that we develop has to be sophisticated enough not only to give expression to the transphysical dimensions of reality, but also the physical dimensions. And we have to be able to say, in terms of our new metaphysics, what is the physical world? How do we abstract it from our experience? And we talked about this last time. Remember, I talked about how the scientific world is abstract that of the field of experience by focusing attention only on the meat senses, the body senses, only on operations of measurement, right? And then doing the experiment ritual, and then we create this world from that. We abstract the physical world out of experience. But experience comes first. And so now, our philosophy is not trying to say, given there's a physical world, how do I exist? Instead, it says, given that I exist, how does the physical world show up in my experience? See that difference? Explanation of the concrete versus from the abstract. So Whitehead, and in my dissertation, I go through this very clearly, I think, in the first few chapters. Chapter 4, I think, of my dissertation is called What is the Physical World? And what I do in those chapters, 3 and 4, I guess, is to say, what is the physical world within experience? How do we abstract the physical world out of experience? And then once we understand that the physical world is an abstraction from experience, we realize that we can't possibly explain experience on that basis. We need something else. We need a fresh approach. Right? And the fresh approach involves understanding how the field of experience is divided into subject and object, right? And how, in our own experience, we construct a world of objects. Out of the field of experience, how do we divide it up into interrelated objects? And so that's a different task. It's a whole different understanding of philosophy. Philosophy is trying to explain the abstractions, starting with the fact of concrete experience, not trying to explain concrete experience starting with the abstractions. This is really, really important. And this is one of the most fundamental divides between the approach I'm taking and the normal modern approach, is that this starts with experience. And then it divides experience up into the concrete and the abstract, into events and forms, which Whitehead calls objects. That's funny. That's another of those funny usages. We think of objects as being concrete things out there, but by object, Whitehead means an abstraction. I'm sorry. Okay. So that's one of the main points I want to make here, is that we're starting from the concrete. And then, okay, so we start from the concrete, and we divide it up into objects and events. So we say, okay, I am now going to do a phenomenology in which I describe my experience through the conceptual categories of ideas and events, or forms and events, or objects and events, okay? So I look around at my experience, and I see the event of the pillar, and I see the form of the pillar. Right? It's that event because it has that form, which distinguishes it. But it's an event. It's happening. The pillar is happening right now. You're happening. You're happening, right? So you're events in my field, and you have characteristics. And events are divided from each other by the different characteristics they have. Right? So now I get this category, events and forms. Now Whitehead gets this far. And he goes through a whole complex process. First we abstract sense objects, like a patch of blue. And then we get perceptual objects, which is like the perceptual object of the cup has green and white and round and cylindrical and so forth, right? So it's another object. And so now here I am in this field of objects and events. And the question is, like, how do I relate to this? Like, what's going on? Am I all alone in here? Are there other subjects out there? Are the other events I'm seeing real, or are they just inside of me? This whole thing comes up, right? And so Whitehead makes this big, bold move. And Whitehead says, here's how it works. He says, I'm looking at events out there, and I'm an event also. Right, so now, the perceiver is brought back into the body, back into the world. It's not that there's a world out there, and I'm somehow out here observing it. It's that there's a world and I'm inside of it. I'm an event in the world, and you're events in the world. Right? And so it's all events everywhere. Right? And so now, this whole subject-object split goes away. Right? Because every object out there, every event, every you, is also a subject for which I am an object. Right? And so Whitehead takes this even to the level of atoms or subatomic particles. They are subjects. Right? And so the whole world becomes, as Christian De Quincey says, an intersubjective play. Everything which is actual is a center of consciousness. So I'm an event, you're an event, and there's the texture of relationships and events. So the whole mind-body problem now goes away. It's gone. Right? Because every body is a mind, and every mind is a body of some kind. Right? In other words, to be actual, to be a real thing, is to be an experiencing subject. And the functioning of an experiencing subject is the unification of the past into a single new experience. And when the past has been unified into a new experience, then there's a new objective reality for other people to experience. And so everything that happens, everything that has an outside, also has an inside. This is hardly an original idea. I mean, this is Teilhard's idea, it's Whitehead's idea, it's Schiaparelli's idea, it's an ancient idea, right? As above, so below. Oh, I am the universe assembling itself into Eric. You're the universe assembling itself into Madeline, right? And we regard each other. You have become real. You become an object an eighth of a second ago, a tenth of a second ago. I now take you in as causing me, as part of my world, and then I do something which you take in as part of your world, right? And so we're all reciprocally creating each other. Everything in the world that happens, the way entities in the world come to have a character is by deciding to have that character. And so you take a subatomic particle, right? It at the beginning of its process, it doesn't have a character. It has a matrix of possible characters. And it chooses one. And then it becomes that it chose. In this moment, as I begin to speak, I am unformed. But I decide which word to say next. And when I make that decision, it becomes actual. And then it becomes a reality for you. Right? So all the objective realities that we experience are the results of other entities making decisions. So nothing comes to have a character without first being conscious and making a decision. So this is a completely different way of understanding reality. And my intention is to start with this idea, which we'll expand on next week, and build it up into a whole cosmology. So instead of starting with atoms, I want to start with what I'm calling actual occasions of experience. Yes?
I was just thinking about something while you were talking, that at every moment we take in everything and use it for our next moment.
Yes.
And I know we've talked about the fact that everything we take in is an abstraction of that real thing, so it kind of changes throughout the progression.
That's right.
But we're not putting it into words as we're an occasion. Mm-hmm. So putting into words makes it an abstraction. But by just prehending something directly, does it really have to become an abstraction?
Yes.
Or do we have a way of kind of taking in the whole thing?
Well, this is why Whitehead talks about conceptual prehension and causal prehension. So Whitehead says, we do in fact take things in just as they are fully. And then we abstract from them their character. And he says that this happens all the way down at the level of subatomic occasions. Right? That subatomic occasion takes in the universe and analyzes it into a probability matrix. And then it decides. Right? And so the actual subatomic particle has to have the capacity to abstract from the universe certain abstract patterns on the basis of which it makes a decision going forward. And so conceptual prehension or abstraction is built into the nature of any actual event. Nothing becomes actual that can't think in that sense. Now, that's not language yet. The difference between that and language is mysterious and really important. But I haven't figured it out. I'm working on it. Right? But somehow language is a different kind of abstraction process than the process that's involved in atoms and molecules. But they're both abstraction processes.
But like you said, everything is going to abstract. I mean, there could be one thing, but all the different events will abstract differently.
Yes.
Out of it.
That's right.
And to different degrees of wholeness, I would think, that some events could abstract more than some others, perhaps.
That's
I just
right.
wonder if that means that there would be a potential that there could be an event that could abstract, like God.
What absolutely.
Abstracts the whole thing.
That's it.
So can
right.
we come close to that? Can we learn?
We can be there. We can go there.
Okay,
we can.
Then we can get rid of the abstract. And we can.
Well, no, we can't get rid of it because it's always there, but we can subsume it in our understanding. Right? So the idea of getting rid of the abstract.
Okay, that was wrongly said.
It's important, though. It's really important because people say it all the time. And Gebser is at great pains to point this out. If we say getting rid of the abstract, we're trying to go backward. But instead, we want to go forward into the integral. Because we're not trying to get rid of the abstract, but we're trying to see the concrete fully and appreciate the abstract as a kind of ornament without being lost in it.
So you'd see all the different abstractions at once.
Yeah, that's it. See, all the, or you know, something like that. Have some sense of all the multiplicity of possible abstractions. And so learning not to take any abstraction too seriously, but seeing each one as a kind of illumination, right, or interpretation. And so we want to become lighter with concepts. We don't want to get rid of them. That's the whole thing about the integral, right, is that there is a place in the integral world for the intellect. But it's not the same place it has in the mental world where it dominates everything. Yeah, Caleb?
I was thinking about decision earlier this week and then what communication in the trans-physical worlds might be like different than the physical world. And there's this, I was just trying to, like, how would you tune into different people? And I thought that perhaps in the trans-physical world you didn't have the same filters, like you could actually communicate with everyone all at once. But I started to imagine that there's this transparency that didn't have the same will to decide, because like it's almost like communication would come in and I would just respond out of my truest nature without any sort of like inhibitions or almost this is a bad word, but programmed or mechanical in a way.
Yeah, see, this is again very aggressive thinking.
You see what I'm saying? Like,
I know, but it's wrong, I think. It's
if I'm purely, if I'm totally like transparent to you in the transphysical, then if you ask me a question, I just tell you what I know. And there's, whereas in the physical, like I might question like, well, I want to look good, or I might want to not offend someone with my language. And so there's these all these decisions in the physical world that are masking and separating that don't seem to happen perhaps in the transphysical. And my point is that there's a different type of decision making that happens in a place where everything's transparent versus here.
You're right. And our job is to work out specifically what that means. That's what we're going to be doing. I agree. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand what you were... This point about subsuming the abstractions... And I actually don't remember quite what the phrase was that you used.
Well, the point I'm making is that we, in New Age circles, there's a tendency to think of mind as fundamentally destructive. So I've read books which say mind is the slayer of the real. Right, so there's this idea that somehow once we start to think and once we make distinctions, we're lost and everything is fucked up and it's dualistic and it's ego. And so if we could just stop thinking, everything would be fine. If we could just go back and get rid of the thinking, then we'd be okay again. We'd be whole again. Right? And Gebser says, and I agree with him, that we can't go back. Right? The human consciousness is not going to go backwards and regress into some pre-mental state. But rather, we're going to move forward into an integral state in which we can think mentally and mythically and magically and understand the way that all those truths are coordinated with each other. And so we're not trying to get away from self-consciousness. Like you're saying in the transphysical world, because it's more transparent, it'd be less self-conscious. I'm not sure that's true. I think that this sense of self-consciousness, which I understand as being a breakthrough of our transcendence. You know, this whole idea of self-reflection is very mysterious. Actually, what the hell does self-reflection really mean? It's not clear, but I have an idea of what it means. And what it means, I think, is that self-reflexivity is the first conscious awareness in an embodied being of its participation in the absolute transcendence of the divine. There's an absolute freedom and an absolute transcendence of the divine. The divine, no matter what it creates, is always free to create more and is never trapped by anything it creates. So the divine is always more than the sum of all the universes it could possibly manifest. And in the same way, we are more than any self-definition we can generate, because any self-definition we generate is already less than what we are. Because we're understanding the definition, seeing that even in understanding a definition, we're transcending it. Right? And so this odd, awkward transcendence, the sense that really we're not part of the universe, that we don't actually fit in the universe, but that somehow we're a misfit, that we don't really find our home in any universe because we transcend all universes. This is the sense of transcendence, right? And it's awkward, and it's irritating, and it's incomplete, and it's bright, and it's the absolute consciousness coming through us, right? And it's the origin of our spiritual impulses. And to think that it's better to go back to being asleep is to miss the point. We want to get more awake. We want to have more freedom, more wakefulness, not less. And I think as we go into the higher, the transphysical world, that ought to be the case. There ought to be more of a sense of freedom and more of a sense of participation in the divine freedom rather than less.
So I was hearing Caleb was saying something similar to that, saying that in the transphysical world it should be easier for an occasion to apprehend something objectively or with the abstractions not getting in the way. And but then I heard you say that that's not necessarily the case. But now it just sounded like, is that confusing? It sounded like we have greater freedom in the transphysical worlds. And to me, that means that we can look at something without the abstractions limiting us, in a sense. which I don't know if that's what you're saying or not, but...
Well, I'd say we have more freedom to be authentic. We're more purely authentically our unique selves because we're not as hidden to ourselves. And so in that sense, we become almost more automatically interactive.
It sounds like that's what he was just saying, but...
That sounds like a reduction of freedom when you say you just respond to the...
That sounds like a reduction. You're saying just responding, right?
But you're responding out of your like total authenticity, so you're responding...
But what is your total authentic nature?
Well, I think each of us have distinctly unique authentic natures.
Maybe.
That are inhibited by this physical world.
But in some sense, our uniqueness is given to us by the world.
And it's participatory, so it's this...
And what I'm noticing is that there's a part of us that transcends every definition that really isn't that unique.
Yeah, I would think that's our oneness, our commonality.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that becomes more clear. I don't know.
So I think part of what I'm now finally hearing is that I think that this whole thing about being authentic to ourselves... I think there's truth to that, but there's a distinction in mainstream philosophy between fact and value. And I think that it's like, I don't think we can escape value even in the astral or I don't think we can escape value in the transphysical worlds. On the one hand, so the way I came to that, and I'm still trying to articulate this, but it sounds like kind of what you're saying is that we can remove some of these bullshit filters that kind of get in the way of, like, I want to look good or whatever. And to me, like, if you use that term filter, I don't think we can remove all filters because, you know, fact and value are intertwined. And so I think there's a tremendous contradiction in what you're saying.
You know what I want to do?
Yeah.
This is a very frustrating conversation for all of us. And it's frustrating because I'm letting this conversation go on and appreciating it because the confusion that we're generating here is the confusion I hope to clarify as we go forward. But I'm hoping that as we move forward, you're going to start getting a vocabulary and a set of concepts which are going to make this conversation much more interesting and much more comprehensible. And that's my hope. Right. And so I know this is confusing and frustrating. This is the confusion I'm hoping to clarify as we move forward.
I don't know what I'm about to say, but like I feel like I've just been... I don't have as much of a philosophical background, and so this is just... It's not confusing to me at all.
Good. So what's going on here?
I don't know how to say it, but I'm just enjoying the process, and it's just a nice process, and it feels really good, and it's moving more to my...
That's great.
To the way I experience
it. I'm so glad. That's very encouraging.
So I just wanted to say that.
Bill, thank you. Thank you.
Okay, let's see. So we have language, we have concepts, abstractions that powerfully affect what we see in the world because we see it through concepts. But in fact, we have the possibility of getting the root experience without the concepts, as we use language and so forth to deconstruct all that.
Everybody keeps saying
that's
without
the
language.
Authentic place.
I don't agree.
Okay.
See, I'm just not sure about it, right? Because it's regressive talk.
How do you mean? Why is it regressive?
Because it talks about eliminating concepts, seeing without concepts.
No. It's more of the freedom. It's more of that spectrum of possibilities that you can access without the limiting concepts.
The question is, what is the relationship? What is the place of concepts, of ideas, of forms in the actual world? What are they? How do they get there? How do they function? Right? And is it the case that there is something which precedes the concepts? And is that something absent concepts? I doubt it. I think that whatever precedes everything else must have all the concepts in it, not no concepts in it.
Yeah, that's okay. It's a possibility space, right? So you talk about...
Look, let me say this. There, when it becomes apparent to us that there is a constructed element in our appreciation of reality,
we start to think, well, gee, maybe I can get back before that. Maybe I can get back to something which is unconstructed, right?
You know exactly what I'm talking about when you go to Aurobindo, right? Because that's, doesn't he talk about levels of ignorance? And as long as we're in that appearance, that's a limit, that's a level of ignorance.
Yes. That was my question. Does abstraction require ignorance?
That's beautiful. That's it. That's a brilliant question.
Right.
Does abstraction require ignorance? Thank you so much, Michael. That clarifies it so well. Does abstraction require ignorance? The modern assumption is that it does. The modern assumption is that if you're going to have abstraction, you're losing the whole. Right?
Reduction.
The reduction of the whole, right? You're that once you abstract, you slay the real, because the real is not actually divided. And so concepts are distortions and illusions. And in order to get to reality, we have to remove the filters. Right? That's this idea. I'm not sure that's right. I think that in some way, the concepts are part of what it means to be real. And that we can't really talk about getting rid of concepts or getting behind them, because they're always part of what's real.
Aren't they just the rules of the real?
I don't know what that means exactly, but
well, the consistent natures.
I don't know. That's well,
once you have any sort of reflection, you have to have abstraction.
But what I want to say is that you can have abstraction without ignorance. That's the key.
What's that look like?
What? Fully experiencing the moment and abstracting at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
Being
exactly.
In it and contemplating while you're riding the
That's
bike
it.
And being aware that you're
That's
riding the bike.
It. That's it, right? Okay. And that's what we can abstract without being in ignorance. That's the integral.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to point to, right? Yeah. Is that we can be abstracting without destroying the unity. And without positing any kind of reductionism. But in other words, we can illuminate the field of experience with the texture of interconnections and love it and drop it.
That's what I feel like I do anyway.
Yeah, okay, great. That's
You're
great.
Right. I do that anyway. I don't.
Well, we all do.
I'm not trying to
but most of us get, most of us are very attached to our ideas and our limits. I am. Mm-hmm. You better off than I am, right? But like, you know. I'm attached to my ideas.
We are those limitations.
What?
That's what our personality is, anyway. Mm-hmm. It's where we drew the boundaries.
That's why we are more attached to our limits than anything else. Right? The thing
that's
we're
not,
most
that's
afraid
not me.
Of...
I'm afraid of limits, and I've always, my whole life, moved to the limitless. That's been my goal. That's always been my goal.
Sounds like a limit you got going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's your project, great, you know, but it's your project, and it's different from other projects, right? Most people, most of the time, except when they're in a spiritual, inspired state like you are, cling to their limits, right? That's I know that's true for me. I mean, I intellectually know that I'm God, but I'm terrified of opening up to my own infinity because it would swamp me, right? I would cease to. It feels like I would cease to exist in all that magnificence.
That's what yoga is about: is working with that
softness
experience.
Absolutely.
And just, you know, you realize you're, and then you let go, and
that's
then,
right.
And then whatever, and
yeah.
You just work with that back and forth. The push
that's
and pull,
right.
The rigid, the chaos.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
Eric, what did you say? You would cease to exist in what?
In the effulgence of my own brilliant light. how could I keep my individuality in my divine state? It would be too interconnected, too brilliant, too beautiful. I wouldn't be Eric anymore. I'd be God, and then I'd be lost. Right? That's
Eric
what I'm afraid of.
Yeah, Eric would be gone.
I don't think that's true, but I'm afraid of it. I'm afraid of my own infinity. Infinity scares the piss out of me.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Oh, wait.
Becky. Then I guess my question would be... You almost got my name. I guess then the question would be, when we're going between these different aspects of the integral, is it a conscious choice then? Is it becoming a conscious choice? Like we're saying, in this moment, I'm in the mental. In this moment, I need to be in the mythical. In this moment, I need to be in the magical. Like, for me, it doesn't feel like it's a conscious choice. I'm just floating between sometimes. But in the integral, would it be then it's a choice at each time?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that because... that's a great question, but I do know
that in the integral, it should be fairly easy to translate back and forth. And when we're in any one mutation, you wouldn't be blind to the others. Mm-hmm. They'd be there simultaneously, as they are right now. Yes. I mean, right
we
now.
We would be transparent to them.
Yeah, like right now, we are living in magical consciousness. We are because every moment is a synchronicity and it's coherent. That's the magical consciousness, which illuminates the mandala-like moment, nature of experience, moment to moment. And it's always happening. And if it wasn't happening, there'd be nothing else possible. And then we also live in the mythic all the time, right? Because we personify everything, right? The world is alive for us if we don't think about it too hard, right? It's all just part of a living display, right? And it's meaningful. And the events that happen to us, we all know somehow that the universe is speaking to us at every moment, and it's right like that, right? That's the mythic level. And it's true, right? And then there's the mental level, which is the level at which there's space and time and causality, and that's also true, right? And so there's no reason we have to be in any one of those exclusively. But up until this point in the evolution of consciousness, we have dwelt in one or the other exclusively. And so Gebser's vision is that we can now dwell in all of them in mutual diaphanity.
So we're not necessarily making a conscious choice when we're moving between them, but it naturally happens because they're all on the same time.
Yeah, and also I don't know if it'll alternate or be simultaneous or I don't know.
Integral, so it'd be all of those. It'd be you could choose sometimes, sometimes you don't choose.
I just don't know. I honestly don't know. The point is, I don't know. See, what is the integral experience going to be like when it fully matures?
It's going to be fun.
That's it. It'll be fun. But you know, what specifically is this going to be like? I don't know yet. We're all just trying to feel our way into it. This is a very exciting time because we are feeling our way into a new universe. Bill.
So you probably think, Aurobindo has a fair idea of the potential.
He's got a vision of it. Well, yeah. And the vision is that we dwell in Brahman consciousness. Is that at each moment we know ourselves to be the divine of which we are an expression, fully and completely, without any sense of alienation.
While at the same time we can have concepts and think about things.
That's right.
So in the Dhanahara path, for example, that's a very, Buddhism I think is what it's a very advanced state to be at a place of non-doing, while doing.
Yeah.
To express that. And
yeah.
So there's an initial stage where you have to deconstruct the stuff that's in the way of getting the experience you just described about the divine. And then you have freedom of your consciousness.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's how it has been. And the question is whether or not, as we move into this new mutation of consciousness, it'll be different.
Yeah. Well, your point is well taken. About the misunderstanding of, the concept slate of reality and so forth. That's what we're talking about.
So I'm saying that if we're going to make intelligible sense out of a universe in which mystical experiences are possible and valid, and in which occult experiences are possible and valid, and in which physical experiences are possible and valid, we can't start with the physical world. We have to start with experience. Right? And then very vaguely here, I'm not trying to be too precise, we realize that there's a process of interpretation through which we create shared worlds. Right? We create a shared world of interpretation, a shared way of interpreting the world, which becomes our world. And we don't have to be bound by the world that we construct. Please, sir.
But aren't we still, in a sense, constructing a world?
Yeah. But we can construct a world knowing that's what we're doing.
Conscious abstraction.
Right? And then we understand something different, very different. We have a very different sense of attachment, a very different sense of our destiny, of our nature. Right, because our anthropology is rooted in the unconditioned, not rooted in the conditioned. So we start with experience, right?
And then we say, okay, within the world of experience, through our interpretations, we define worlds. And there's a physical world, a waking world that we define in the mental mutation, and a dreamlike world we define in the mythical mutation, and a synchronistic world we define in the magical mutation. They're all different. We live in all these different worlds. And in terms of our current project, we start with experience, and we talk about events and objects. And we then, as you'll see in the readings, right, we get this idea of actual occasions, which is the simplest possible case of an event, smallest possible event is an actual occasion. And these actual occasions are drops of experience. And so every actual thing in the world is a drop of experience. Everything actual in my world is a drop of experience in its own world. Now, these little drops of experience, these actual occasions, they are synchronicities. And so this is transparent to the magical. And they're all alive. And so this way of thinking about the world makes it completely alive and therefore transparent to the mythic mutation. And the actual occasions are objects, which allows us to use objective mental thought on them. And so by defining the world in terms of actual occasions, instead of atoms, I now have an objective world that's transparent to life and magic. So I now have a whole different way of building up the world, which is now completely transparent to the play of life, meaning, intention, right? All that's built into each actual occasion, but I can now talk about these actual occasions as objects, so I can use my mind to think about them in a clear way, and then I can construct a cosmology out of these actual occasions, and this cosmology will be totally transparent to the magical and the mythical, and as we'll see, it makes the transphysical worlds a completely natural extension of the physical world. And it begins to give us a lot of clues about how science needs to be changed in order to accommodate these larger worlds. That's the project.
So you said it's synchronized, each event is synchronized?
It's a synchronicity. It's a synchronicity, which makes it magical. It's alive, which makes it mythical. And it's an object, which makes it mental. And so I'm claiming that Whitehead's idea of actual occasions is a fundamentally integral idea and is adequate to the new mutation and lets us, and in terms of actual occasions, as you'll see, it's easy to account for the success of science and it's easy to account for the existence of transphysical worlds. So it moves us onto a whole new metaphysical foundation. Instead of starting with science and trying to describe everything from there, we're starting from experience and describing both science and occultism and mysticism as modifications of the structure of each individual experience.
I feel like we should like just go into the wilderness, you know, this group, and work on this for a while.
Well, you know, I'm glad. Before we go in the wilderness, I want to have this class. No, this is important, right? Because my vision is this. My vision is that if we have the right language for expressing the transphysical worlds, they will become clearer to us and more workable. Right? And so, once we've learned this language, then let's go into the woods and talk this language and make it real. Okay. Thank you very much.